Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. I am told that last night was the actual full moon, first of this new year, presumably, and there's a name for this midwinter moon, a name given by indigenous tribes of North America. They call it a full wolf moon. Full wolf moon. Named, I think, because it was during this time of the year that the tribes would hear wolves howling outside their camps and villages. And I summon up that imagery because it sort of fits the first part of tonight's program. And I can tell you, I think we have a wonderful lineup for you. Been a while since I have hosted a full-on UFO show. Tonight, we jump into it with both feet, covering some ground that is somewhat familiar territory for me because it involves stories and people that I pursued in my own work, but hopefully with some new detail and context for you. Coming up in this hour, in just a few minutes, encounters with star people. That's the generic term used by American Indians to describe what many of the rest of us might call aliens or ETs, visitors from somewhere else. As we will learn, indigenous peoples view these encounters a lot differently from many of us, and they tend to refer to the star people as their ancestors. That's a view not just of one tribe, but almost universally throughout tribes of North America. Anthropologist and former university professor Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark has worked with indigenous tribes most of her life and has collected an astounding number of close encounter stories from people who are not always open and accessible for non-Indian researchers or journalists. All this is compiled in a wonderful new book that I had the pleasure of devouring this weekend. Dr. Clark will join us momentarily. And then we'll be shifting gears to talk about government secrecy and whistleblowers, specifically about people who have come forward, voluntarily or not, with fantastic stories about supposedly classified programs focused on UFOs, recovered saucers, reverse-engineered technology at places like Nevada's infamous Area 51 military base, which was, as you know, a blank spot on the map 25 years ago, but now is a name known all over the world, specifically because of a whistleblower named Bob Lazar and a UFO researcher, a former CIA pilot named John Lear. But there are other whistleblower names not as well known as Lear and Lazar, but are damned important in the big picture. Veteran researchers Grant Cameron and Scott Crane have spent more than 20 years tying together these various loose ends and trying to make sense of the larger story, the big picture. And finally, they put their research into a book that's available to the general public, finally, at last. They did this with its careful and, I think, meticulous guidance of historian Richard Dolan, who, in my opinion, is one of the most important figures ever to track down the history of this strange and befuddling subject. Richard Dolan will join us at the top of the second hour to introduce this new book, and then Grant Cameron will be here to share with us his unique insight based on what I consider a truly monumental pile of hard work and sheer tenacity. We might even have a surprise guest join us during that part of the discussion, someone who was directly involved with the events that are described in this new book, which is entitled UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. Just have to see how that goes, but man, what a lineup. If you have been jonesing for a good old-fashioned UFO Donnybrook with spies and lies and dirty tricks, cover-ups, secret bases, disinformation schemes, and whistleblowers who risked everything to tell their tales, then this is the show for you. Enough to get us all out there howling at the full wolf moon. Webmaster Tim Binal is with me tonight, and if I'm not mistaken, he should be recovering from a birthday celebration, which was yesterday. Reason I know that is because Tim and I are Facebook friends, so I get a reminder, you know, about the occasion, those little notes that tell you when it's somebody's birthday. So happy belated birthday to Tim. He and I have put together our usual assortment of news items and oddities from the past couple of days, listed on the Coast website under Naps News. Two of those stories there relate to the pervasive power and influence of the Internet. There's a thoughtful article about an Internet pioneer whose opinion about the net and the net effect of the net on the world has changed, drastically changed. Why he thinks the Internet has devolved into a sort of a threat to all of us. And there's another article which details the steps that you could take if you want to disappear from the web, vanish into cyberspace without leaving a trace, maybe hiding from the government or an ex-spouse, whatever the reason, some handy advice if that's the way you want to go. Also posted under Naps News, an article that could be a warm-up to our first guest. It's about an Indian tribe in the Pacific Northwest which is being hounded, almost literally hounded, by some sort of a noisy beast. And the article even has a tape recording of the strange sounds that have been emanating from a swamp that is near this tribe's reservation. On the UFO front, the story of recent sightings on the East Coast and the almost laughable series of fibs told by the military to try and make public interest kind of dry up. It's almost textbook what the military's been doing with the UFO subject for half a century, and which they try in this case, and it's hilarious. It's funny, but also not funny. Along with that story is a photo taken from the space station, which seems to show a gigantic, and I mean enormous, black triangle floating above the Earth, but below the ISS. Whose craft is it? I'm sure NASA's going to let us know any day now. A story about new research into teleportation, which I'd say is highly speculative. Maybe that's the polite way to put it, but what the heck, figured I might find it to be a fun read. And then a truly provocative kind of an essay tying together research into lost civilizations and our ongoing fascination with the history of ETs and human beings. It's a long piece, so carve out some time to read it when you can. Naps News on the Coast website. While you're there, you maybe check out the link to become a Coast Insider. As we've told you before, for pennies a day, you gain access to this huge archive of previous programs hosted by George Norrie and Ian Punnett, John B. Wells, and yours truly. And, of course, these are interviews you simply don't hear on terrestrial radio unless your dial is right here. There are other goodies and benefits that come along with your membership, but I'll let you read about them online, and I promise that's my first and last and only pitch of the night. Now then, throw a log on the fire, tuck in those pajamas, fire up your Mr. Coffee machine, maybe check the lock on the door and the latch on your windows, because it's going to get spooky real soon. Back in a moment with Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark and Encounters with Star People. I'm George Knapp, and you're listening to Coast AM. Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark is a professor emeritus at Montana State University, has dedicated her life and career to working with indigenous populations. She's been adopted by three of the Plains tribes, the Cheyenne, the Blackfeet, and the Lakota Sioux, is the author of several children's books and the best-selling Sisters in the Blood. She works as a consultant to American Indian tribes and indigenous communities worldwide, and has used her relationships with different tribe members to sort of pierce the veil and be able to talk about something that for a lot of non-Indian researchers is pretty tough to talk about. Encounters with Star People is the title of the new book. It is a tremendous read. And Dr. Clark, thanks for joining us on the program.
It's my pleasure.
So let me get this straight. You've been adopted by the tribes, and you have Sixkiller in your name, which is certainly sounds like a Native American name, but you're not by blood Native American, or are you?
Oh, I am. But I'm not a full blood.
Okay. You know, as I read these incredible stories, and we'll get into a lot of them, it occurs to me, I mean, the most obvious thing is that Native American Indians, view these encounters differently than, say, people from my cultural background. You don't have the sheer terror because it seems like they've had some sort of conditioning. They've grown up with these stories. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a part of the traditional stories and has been handed down for generations. And so that when these encounters occur, in many cases, they just expect it to, it's just a part of the normal life.
How far back does it go? You know, because one of the criticisms that we hear from the debunkers who don't like UFOs, ETs, star people to be given any kind of credence, they'll say, well, it's just people see this on television, they see the movies, and they reflect what they see in the mass media. Obviously, this goes back with Native tribes a lot further than that.
Well, you know, I can only speak, you know, like we have a saying among my people that we have the stories that are older than time. And I'll tell you a story that my grandmother, that I heard at her knee, she said that the star people first came to Earth many, many years ago. And at that time, on the Earth lived the sun people. And the star people came to visit. And when the sun people saw them, they went out to greet them. And they brought them into their village, and they gave them the best housing and prepared food for them and welcomed them to stay. And the star men stayed for quite a long time. And they taught the sun people many wondrous things, and the sun people taught them many wondrous things. And when the time came for the men to go back to the stars, the women, the sun people, were very sad because some of them had grown very attached to the star men. So a great council was held, and it was decided that those who wanted to stay behind could stay, and those that wanted to return to the stars could go. And so my grandmother would always say to me, "So in your veins are the blood of the star people and the sun people. And always remember that." And so I grew up believing that. And so I think that it goes back so far in our history that we connect with the cosmos, that we believe that our people came from Pleiades, that they are a part of us, and there are many tribes. The Maya believe they came from Pleiades. If you look at many, many tribes and many, many indigenous people, there's that strong connection with Pleiades. And they're in historical records and traditional stories that have been passed down through generations.
Well, it's not only ancient generations, but modern times. I know that the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, it becomes a key in the one of Spielberg's movies, right? The Devil's Tower in Wyoming and pointing to those stars up there.
Well, I guess you're right. I didn't make that connection, but yeah, I suppose that's true.
Tell me this, Dr. Clark. You we'll talk about the stories. You collected, I think the book says you collected more than 1,000 of them dating
right
back more than 20 years. How difficult is it for you as a scientist to sort of separate wheat from chaff? I mean, how do you say, what weight do you give these stories? Do you consider it to be literal truth? Do you consider it to be sort of folklore? I mean, because that's what critics would say. Look, this is just a tale told around a campfire. It's something to scare the kids and keep them in line. It's not literally true. So what kind of weight do you give to them?
Well, I think they're absolutely true. I don't question the individuals at all. One of the things that's important to remember is these stories were not told in a dream state or under hypnosis. These are alert recollections of what happened. And they were told in a manner that, you can tell if somebody is lying. You can tell by body language, by, contact, eye contact, various different measures. I mean, I've been interviewing people and collecting data, for 40 years. And so I fully believe the individuals I interviewed.
One of the other avenues that I think could open you up to criticism is you use pseudonyms here.
Right.
And I know I've done some work with the Native tribes on talking about weird stuff and asking them to tell me stories about skinwalkers and Bigfoot and UFOs and ETs. And they don't want to be quoted. It's tough to get through to get them to talk at all, but they certainly don't want to be quoted. And I guess that was a condition for you to get these stories told at all, right?
Well, and the other thing is that, a lot of them feel a tremendous responsibility to their tribes. And they don't want notoriety. They don't want people coming and poking around, their reservation. I mean, they literally would say that, we don't want this unwelcomed attention. But we will tell you what happened as long as you disguise our identity so nobody can figure out who we are. And
well,
I've tried to do that.
Well, you know what people would say. Well, gosh, there's no way to verify that any of this is true. You could have just made it up at your typewriter.
Well, that's true, you know, but I didn't. So, you know, you either have to trust me as a professional or, you know, disregard it. But I did the interviews. I told the stories as they were told to me.
And was it still... Is it still difficult for you to get them to open up? I mean, even though that they trust you at a large degree, they have to worry about ridicule within their own tribes, don't they?
Well, a lot of them, not so much ridicule as
teasing.
Teasing. There's a lot of teasing that goes on, you know, among Native people. And I think I talked about the police officers that were called the Little Green Man Patrol.
Right.
And simply because they had reported a sighting. And some people watch that and see the teasing that goes on, and they don't want to be involved in that. So they keep quiet. If they see something, they won't tell anybody.
You know, I've asked this question a bunch of times on the program, more of speculating for my own gratification than anything else, is what is it about Indian tribes, American Indian tribes, connections to paranormal and paranormal hotspots in particular? You look at the stuff that I've written about in northeastern Utah, a hotspot in the Uinta Basin, Yakima, Washington, Sedona, Dulce. It seems like everywhere you find a UFO paranormal hotspot, there's a Native American connection to it. Why is that? Is it because the Native Americans are paying attention? They're outside looking in the sky, or they have a
connection? I think that's one of the major reasons. I think that several times I was told, you know, people have quit looking at the stars. People don't sit outside and watch anymore. And all they would have to do is go out in their backyard and sit for a few hours, and they'd be amazed at what they see. Turn off those computers and turn off the television set and go outside and watch. I mean, there are people native people that I know that spend every evening outside watching the stars simply because they could tell you any change that happens in the sky because they methodically watch it at night, watch the sky at night. And many of them have said to me that, you know, it's there for anybody to see. Number one, you have to be open to it. If you start out from a skeptical perspective, you're going to deny everything you see. Just open your mind, open your heart, and watch.
That's what I was wondering. It has to be more than just that they're out at night looking in the sky. It seems to be that there are a willingness to open themselves up to these kinds of experiences and let it in.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that that perhaps other cultures are not as open to that whole concept of intelligent life in the universe.
Well, we've grown so educated and sophisticated, I guess we've dumbed ourselves down in some ways. Tell me this, is there a difference in the level of activity that tribes have from tribe to tribe? Say the Cheyenne have more than the Sioux, the Navajo have more than the Paiutes?
You know, I don't think so. I think that, you know, I think that perhaps some of them because of some of their members who've been more outgoing and responsive to mainstream media have publicized more activities within their tribes. But I think that you find it across the tribes. The younger generation is more, I think they're more suspicious. They're not. And sometimes I wonder how much the influence of media has had upon their observations. Because even though they have heard some of the ancient stories, some of them are still afraid. And I didn't find that in the 40 and over group, but I did find it among some of the younger people. The anxiety of experiences. But that was not common among all of them. But that's where I saw the questioning, the more of the fear than and believe me, it wasn't easy for me when I sat down to write this book to determine which stories I was going to tell, because, like you say, I collected over 1,000 stories.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get into as many of those stories as we can, starting with a missing time episode involving a tribal police officer. It's a barn burner. We're talking with Dr. R.D. Sixkiller Clark, Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians, and she's got more than 1,000 of them. When we come back, we're going to jump right in and hear some of them, and keep in mind that these are stories told with conscious memories. They weren't pulled out of somebody's head through the use of hypnosis. The witnesses who told these stories remember them as a conscious memory, and we'll get into them right after this on Coast to Coast AM.
Raincoat or parka? Sandals, shorts, and sunscreen? 680 CJOB has the weather warnings, watches, and alerts you need. Your local weather on 680. 680 CJOB.
Start saving on your tax returns with 68 tax tips brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. Tax tip number 50, first-time home buyer's tax credit. Did you know that if you are planning to buy a qualifying home for the first time this year, you will be eligible for a significant tax credit? In fact, you can be eligible for a credit for up to 15% on $5,000 or $750. To be eligible for this significant saving, you or your spouse cannot have owned and lived in another home in the same year you make your purchase or the four previous years to that. Also, any unused portion of an individual's credit may be claimed by their spouse. Claiming this can result in some significant savings and allow you to move from renter to homeowner with greater ease. For more information about this, as well as other tax tips that benefit you, Google CGA Manitoba for tax advice that can save you money. CGA Manitoba, we see more than numbers.
And I ask the workers, what have unions ever done for you?
They fought for maternity leave.
Retirement plans.
Don't forget Medicare.
Well, obviously, they created those things. But what else have unions ever done?
Paid overtime.
Oh, vacation pay.
Workers' compensation.
Okay, but other than things like that, what have unions ever done for workers?
Pay increases and minimum wages.
Seriously?
This message brought to you by the Construction and Specialized Workers Union, Local 1258.
680 CJOB makes it easy to stay connected.
On the web.
CJOB.com goes deeper with our news, sports, and weather coverage 24/7. And if you're not close to your radio, you can listen online. Or if you missed a show, check out the audio vault for past programs. Don't forget to weigh in on the hot topic of the day by answering CJOB's question of the day. If you have an idea for a story, click on the news tip link and send us some details. For breaking news, traffic, and weather, it is 680 CJOB. Or anytime at CJOB.
This is Coast to Coast AM. If you have an opposing view to tonight's program, we invite you to contact us. Please email your comments to webmaster@coasttocoastam.com.
His wife, and they have a missing time experience. Tell us about it.
Well, they were going to take the weekend. Both of them are, she was a teacher and he was a police officer. They were going for the weekend to celebrate their anniversary, and along the way, in a very isolated spot, actually took place just a few miles from the reservation, they come upon some dead cattle, and he gets out of the car. He stops the pickup and gets out to investigate. And when he comes back, you know, he's so shocked because there's no evidence that anyone had killed them. The grass is not stomped down. There's a lot of mutilation. So he gets back in the pickup and plans to get away and to notify someone when he gets within a distance that he can do that. Instead, all of a sudden, a craft appears. And the next thing they remember is they're sitting on the opposite side of the road. He drives into Billings and realizes when he gets there, because they always did this on their anniversary, is to go there on Friday night, get there, order room service, and watch movies on the TV set. And when they get there, they had left in plenty of time to do that. But when they get there, they discover that the restaurant is closed, and that's when they realize that several hours of time is gone missing. And then they get to the room, and he realizes that his weapon is gone. And so he gets back in the vehicle, drives all the way back to the site looking for this weapon. And when they find it thrown over into a ditch on the side of the hill, over the side of the hill, and the weapon is melted. And he showed it to me. I saw it. So I believe him.
Sorry, it's a .357, I think, I remember,
right,
in the story. It's a valuable weapon.
Right. And he said it was, he was so glad that it was his, because how would he ever explained this happening to his department?
Wasn't there some detail in the story about that he and his wife had pulled over because they saw dead cow parts on the road,
right,
or next to the road?
That's the reason why it stopped, because he saw these dead cattle. And so he stopped to investigate.
All and carved up.
Pardon?
All carved up and sliced up.
Well, they had, yeah. So it was, and these individuals are reliable individuals. They're not people that are out to, you know, to tell a story just to make something up. I mean, they were, and they were really concerned that people should be aware of this, that if you're out at night in the middle of nowhere and you see something strange, there's no need to dally. Just get yourself to where you're going, because they didn't even know what happened to them. And I've seen them a few times since then, and they still have no recollection of what happened to them.
I know this is a conscious memory on their part, but obviously there's missing memory there. Have they been tempted to try regression and retrieve some of that?
Not that I know of. I don't think they really have too much interest in doing that, you know, from what I understand, they suffered no signs of PTSD. You know, they were matter of fact in the way they reported it to me and the way they told it to me. This is what happened, and it was like a police officer talking. You know, these are the facts, and we've gone on with our lives, but we just want people to know that sometimes out here in the West, on these lonely highways, you don't need to stop and check out everything.
It seemed to me one of the startling details was when they came back to look for the gun, the cow parts that had been all over the place
were gone.
They were gone.
And it was interesting to me, too, because he was talking about this stuff. And when we parked and got out of the vehicles and he was walking me through the stages of where all this occurred, I looked over in a pasture across the way, and there were cattle there grazing in the field.
Would he allow you to take a photo of the gun or do analysis on the gun? I wonder if he's kept it, because that would constitute physical proof of some sort.
You know, he never offered, and I never asked. One of the things that I tried to do was only tell the stories as they told them. I did not try to put any influence, involve myself in any way in the story. I think too often that's what skeptics pick up on, is, you know, here is this researcher who isn't, they're biased. They're not non-biased at all, because they keep interfering in the story and putting themselves in the story. And I tried not to do that. So he never offered, I never asked. If I ever see him again, which, you know, is a strong possibility, I could ask him, but I didn't ask him at the time. I could ask him whatever happened to the gun.
Well, I think that'd be a pretty cool, at least a photograph of the gun. It'd be, you know, to bolster the story. I mean, obviously your reason for writing this is different from maybe the agenda that we have in looking for what you'd call proof. But I'd love to see it if you ever come up with it. You have another story in there about an Eskimo village where basically everybody who lived there ended up missing. Can you tell me that?
Well, you know, there are a number of historically, there are stories about the Eskimo villages, and I talk about that, how it's in, there have been recorded histories by Mounties of villages that have disappeared, and all the inhabitants have disappeared.
But this is not just a matter of them pulling up stakes and moving somewhere else.
They're just gone.
And they leave their belongings behind, their food that's
absolutely
on the stove. And,
yeah. So that is not, that has occurred before. And, you know, and what's interesting about it is that people will say, well, you know, the star people must have come. I mean, I heard three or four stories like this of entire families disappearing. Entire family, one family was even of 12 people, and they were gone.
And do you take this a step further, where you track down the names and see if you can find them?
Well, I did do that in a couple of occasions, and every response I got is they just disappeared.
You have a story told by a guy named Willie Joe about his statement is that UFOs often visit the reservation.
Right.
Remember which reservation that is?
Navajo.
That's a big reservation, the main one in Arizona?
Yeah.
Do you recall any?
No, you know, I mean, he told me a story about cloning before there ever was such a thing. You know, I mean, he told me about aliens cloning him. And when you think about that, you know, the story that he told is that they had created another being that looked exactly like him. And they would come back every year and reintroduce him to himself. And so it was an amazing story. And he was so fearful for, he never married and never had children for fear that this would go on into another generation. And was so fearful for his nieces and nephews because he didn't want them to go through with it. But the interesting thing about Willie Joe is Willie Joe said, they may take my image, they may try to take my knowledge, but they can't take the Navajo in me. There are things I know that I never let them know. So even if they planned to transplant him into my culture, he would be suspect. And so I thought that was an interesting insight. That he at least felt he had some control.
You have a couple of cases, incidents where sort of the Native American culture and Western culture sort of overlap. And I'm speaking specifically of Indian tribe members who see UFOs in or around military bases, nuclear
right.
military bases. Tell me some of that.
Well, you know, it used to be that up until, I don't know, in the 80s, I think, South Dakota was just covered with missile sites. And you would see them as you would drive along the highways, you know. Most of them, I think, were in along two-lane roads. But these installations where there would be housing and what would look like a house, but there would be a fence around it, and sometimes a tower would be there. The people that lived in the area knew what they were because they watched them being built. But the average person driving by might not necessarily know, hey, this is a missile site. Occasionally, I would see them outside of Rapid City, and I would see them changing shifts because apparently they would go down in there for a week at a time, and then they would come out, a group would come out, and then a new group would go in, and they were monitoring, you know, the system the whole time. And so I had a number of people tell me of sightings that were hovering over those missile sites. And so that seemed to be a common event. that happened in South Dakota. You don't hear of those very many sightings in South Dakota anymore. And one of the things I think that is attributed to is they were all removed. All the missile sites in South Dakota have been removed.
You know, a colleague of mine, we worked on a research project that eventually became a book, and part of it dealt with skinwalkers and the skinwalker legend among the Utes in northeastern Utah. It was a tough nut to crack. Trying to get Navajo or Hopi or Utes to talk about skinwalkers proved to be pretty much impossible. I want to know if you heard any stories like that in connection with UFOs, ETs, star people.
Well, the one thing that would I could attribute similar to our story as the skinwalkers is that you remember the story where they crash landed on the old rancher's property, and they stayed there for some time before a rescue vessel was sent for them, and the grandfather said, you know, he could see these people. They could disappear in an instant. They could reappear. He was so fascinated by, the fact that they could walk in the water and not get wet. These are kinds of the attributes that would make me think related to a skinwalker. Skinwalkers, in cultures are, some of them are they're not necessarily bad. You know, a hunter can become a skinwalker. He can turn into an animal to pursue his prey. A skinwalker can even be a messenger. For people to openly, I've had people say to me, I'll see somebody in passing on the reservation, and somebody will say to me, well, he's a skinwalker. And, you know, to me, that's just means that this person has the ability to transform himself into something else in order to carry out some kind of a deed. Doesn't mean that it's like a werewolf.
I had sort of heard it as shape-shifting as being a talent. Shape-shifting was something that could be, didn't necessarily good or bad, but the skinwalkers, to become a skinwalker, at least according to the Utes, they had to do something really bad. Let me ask it this way. You ever hear stories about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, something outside of just star people and UFOs, or whether or not there's a connection between Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and the star people?
You know, I heard a lot of that. In among the Maya, not so much among American Indians, but a lot among the Maya, and I'm working on that book right now. But I even had one elder tell me about a hairy man that lived in the jungles, and that these craft would come. And they would, the people that disembarked were large, that he called them giants. And he said that they would go in pursuit of this hairy man. And they could hear the hairy man cry throughout the jungle. And the people were very afraid. And he told me that he thinks that the aliens brought him here. That the Sasquatch was brought here, and he's being watched by these people and from the stars, and that they also have these stories that they talk about them stealing women and children, you know. So they say they seldom see them ever come into the village. So at night, everyone leaves the jungle. If you're out hunting in the jungle, you make sure you get home at night. You don't stay in the jungle at night. And so those are the kinds of stories. A lot of stories about giants that I've come across in among the Maya.
I had heard several stories and read some books, Tribal Bigfoot, for example, some of the tribes seeing Bigfoot or Sasquatch, whatever you want to call it, as a brother, as something to be revered. Others, to, as you said, other tribes worry that they might snatch you or cause you harm. But frequently, with a connection to the star people and visitors, some kind of connection that they're often seen in connection with each other. And again, the same story you're telling, that that maybe the star people brought them here for some purpose.
Well, that's what this elderly gentleman told me, that they when the starships come and the giants get out of the starships, and he says the giants look like men. But they go, and he feels that they are in pursuit of this hairy man, and they hear the hairy man cry throughout the jungle.
Tell me this, Dr. Clark. What is proof? What constitutes proof? What value do you put on these stories? We sort of started with this conversation, but I mean, I would guess that for the tribal members, they don't care whether I believe it, whether I accept this as
really
proof
don't.
Or not. They don't care. But you are a scientist. You have presumably would like to convince your colleagues that you're working on something that's valuable and true.
Well, I think number one, I told the stories as they were told to me. I believe the stories. I believe the people to be honest. They had no other motivation. They did not want their names told so that they weren't seeking fame. They weren't looking to be on reality television. They were telling me a story of what had happened to them. Now, I have no reason to question their truthfulness. I think most of us who've worked with people as long as I have and you know, can tell a liar from somebody who's telling you the truth.
Well, I agree. And the stories you tell have a ring of truth to them. Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, the book is called Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians. I recommend it. It's a good read, and I hope you'll come back and see us again after your next book project is finished. Thanks for being with us. Coming up next, we shift gears. Historian Richard Dolan will join us, and then a little bit later, author Grant Cameron, and perhaps a little surprise guest as well to talk about UFOs, Area 51, and government informants. Shifting gears now, Richard Dolan is well known to listeners of this program, one of the most important writers and authors about the UFO topic. His UFOs and the National Security State, Volumes 1 and 2, among the most important UFO books ever, I think. And he plays a key role in getting together and putting out, publishing the book we're going to talk about for the rest of this evening, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. You know, in our country, we say that we protect whistleblowers. We have laws to protect whistleblowers because we want to encourage people to come forward, to tell us, to spill the beans about government lies, about subterfuge and corruption within the government, all kinds of skullduggery. But the fact is that whistleblowers have a pretty rough time of it. When they come forward, bad things happen to them. The same is true in the area of UFOs. The whistleblowers who've come forward voluntarily have not been treated well, in part because many of them who step forward with wild stories turn out to be bogus, hoaxes, liars. But some of those who come forward are being truthful, and they suffer for it. When we come back, we'll be talking with Richard Dolan to introduce us to this new and important book, and then Grant Cameron will be joining us in just a little bit. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Dolan, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You class the joint up. Give us a little bit of credibility.
Thank you, George. It is always nice to talk with you.
Let's talk about whistleblowers in general. I don't know if you heard part of the introduction a moment or so ago, but it's not a good time for whistleblowers. You know, it seems like when these guys run for president, Bush and Obama, they all want to say the same things, where I'm going to be the most open president ever, and then they get in and they love secrecy. I mean, it was bad enough under Bush. It's been worse for whistleblowers under Obama. Talk to me in general about, as an historian, looking at whistleblowers. I don't know that I would encourage people to come forward anymore if they wanted to spill the beans on something bad.
You and I agree completely on that score. I remember, you know, 8 years of George W. Bush feeling like the nation was getting beaten over the head by a national security apparatus that just was intent on stealing away every single individual liberty and right to privacy that we thought we had. And then we thought, oh, well, okay, a new president, maybe things will be better. And no, it hasn't gotten any better. There is... Effectively, I see no whistleblower protection that's going on anywhere in the United States government. So if you, other than certainly nothing relating to military or national security, you have zero protection.
And then you throw in the inherent weirdness of UFOs, and somebody who would come forward knowing something about that, they're really asking for trouble.
You could be out of a job. You could be liable for prison time. I mean, we don't know how bad it could get, but there is the protections are just not there, and the promises that were made by both of those presidents have been broken badly.
You and I have both had this conversation with Colonel John Alexander, a friend and colleague of mine who lives here in Las Vegas, who said, oh, come on, it's exaggerated. People can come forward and nothing's going to happen to them. And, you know, I think he cites a couple of examples. Well, how would you respond to that a UFO whistleblower? Go ahead.
Read some newspapers or, you know, go on the web and search out the news. All you have to do is basic web searches for what's going on with whistleblowers today. And I think that just proves the lie to it. Not that he's lying, but it's a mistaken claim for sure. With UFO phenomenon, it's never been an easy game. You know, throughout modern history, people have been subjected not simply within the government, but to career pressures of all types, whether in or out of government. If they have a professional position, if they have too much of an interest in UFOs or abductions or anything like that. There's a long history of professional individuals who've suddenly been out of work or even blacklisted from their community. Within the national security apparatus, we're in a dangerous position now. We've got laws like NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which literally gives the military the right to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens without trial, without habeas corpus, and a whole host of other stripping away of our rights and of our privacy. The National Security Agency has a data collection center in Utah that's got every single email that you have ever written, George, and even if you don't have it, they have gotten it. And if you want to get it, maybe you can go knock on their door and ask them. They'll probably tell you don't have a need to know. So that's where we've gotten to in this world today. And it's a world that I think the founders of this great country would say has gone upside down. It's not exact at all what they would have wanted.
Well, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's worse with UFOs. I think your point is well taken.
Let me tell you, I'd like to get some of those emails I've written back. I'll go knock on the door and ask them maybe one of these days. The lack of an outcry is what bothers me the most, is that where is the outrage by the public about what has happened to various rights? You mentioned about the indefinite detention without charges, surveillance of everything.
I think there is an outcry. I think the problem is it's not an organized outcry. Maybe that's what it is. Certainly there's a lot of angry people about what's been going on in the U.S. and also elsewhere in the world. It's not only the U.S., but the U.S. really does lead the way. I think there's a lot of unhappy people. I speak to them every single day, but I think what you have is a feeling of powerlessness. Like, what can I really do about it to fix it? So I might as well just, put up with it and shut up, you know, duck my head and get in line. And I think that's really what's been happening, really, since 9/11 in this country.
You know, you and I are of the same mind in one regard, is that you're an historian, I'm a journalist, and whether or not aliens exist, I mean, neither of us or other researchers can go out and corral an alien or know where something is going to land or a craft is going to appear. We don't know what's on their mind or where they're from, but we can study the government's response to this whole thing, and that's really what's always interested me, the sort of combination paranoia and schizophrenia in responding to what the government has always told us is a bunch of fantasy.
Absolutely, and what we find in the long history, really from World War II onward, I think schizophrenia puts it very well, because you have a situation where, you know, just go back 70 years, pretend that you're on the national security team of Harry Truman, and you find out that all of this is real, that let's say Roswell did happen, or something like that, where technology was recovered. You've got this awesome, incredible reality now to deal with. What do you do? Do you tell the world? You might want to, but of course, if you do that, then you suddenly are going to be probably sharing this technology with a lot of other people you don't want to share it with. So you have to make some very important decisions right off the bat to keep this concealed, and maybe decide to revisit it every so often and think, well, maybe we'll tell the world in 5 years or 10 years. But of course, what happens is that secret just develops its own momentum, its own power. And so there is this schizophrenia where within the classified world, this topic is incredibly important. I think it's the most single most profound issue that they deal with at deeply classified levels. But for that reason, it must be handled so that the public does not get too worked up over it, because this really is a revolutionary topic.
Let's talk about this book. Grant Cameron, I've sort of known him for a long time. He's not a superstar in the UFO world, but people who are in the know in this topic, who've been around it for a long time, really respect the guy because he does his homework. He works really hard. He's tenacious. He runs things down. So I'm sure you were familiar with his work.
Well, let me just tell you, I consider Grant a superstar in the UFO research world. Always have. This book that I am publishing, my company, Keyhole Publishing. I don't just write UFO books, but I do try to publish them. And, in fact, I've got a very big year in 2013 for publishing, including another book of my own. We'll talk about that some other time.
Okay.
But I was approached some time ago to republish this book that Grant and another author, Scott Crane, co-authored about 20 years ago. And this was a particular book. At the time, it was called UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government. And for those of us in the know, this was a classic study. Really, what it was an attempt back around 1990 to confirm or deny, but really to find out what is the truth of the MJ-12 claims that were then a brand new thing within UFO research. And for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, simply MJ-12 is an alleged control group at the very top, the most powerful men who were charged with managing the entire UFO cover-up. And the question was it true? And this is what Grant and Scott looked into. And let me just say, they did a superlative job. The problem was, back then, that book was published by MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. It went through an edition of 1,000 copies, that was it, and it just never got anywhere. I think it was something that researchers knew about, no one else did. For me, this was a highly coveted book in my own research when I did both of my volumes of history, and it's extraordinary. Grant will be able to tell you exactly why. I can tell you a bit why, too. But when I was asked to republish it, I said, look, I would love to do this, but I want to do it on one condition, which is that you guys really update the book and bring it up to speed. I mean, you wrote it in 1990. It was great at that time. It's still a good book, but it could be so much greater if you update it. 2011, 2012, 2013, when we were talking about all this. And that is what they did. That's exactly what they did. So the result, I will just say what I believe is that this is possibly the single best I've ever read, dealing with inside government leaks from credible sources about the reality of the UFO phenomenon. And it's very powerful on that basis.
It's like it's not necessarily for the UFO beginner, although it could be, but it's more like a grad school course, isn't it? Because I mean,
that's a good way to put it. I think that's about right. It's not like intro to UFOs. On the other hand, if you have any little bit of sophistication, any little bit of education, I don't really think it's necessary to have a long background on UFOs to really dig your teeth into this book. It's one of these books, if you have an interest in government secrecy. It seems to me that this is of great interest. If you're interested in government secrecy but you've never done UFOs, then strap yourself in and be prepared for a wild ride, because what you find is that there are some heavy-hitting people at the very top of the national security pyramid who appear in this book who are quoted at length about the reality of UFOs, about the reality of an ET presence here on Earth. And some of this is quite startling. The whole book really evolved out of this attempt years ago to confirm MJ-12. And what Grant and Scott Crane did was to kind of walk through some of the more interesting leaks and inside stories that were current back then and then also today. Back then in the 1950s and 60s, there was a Canadian government employee named Wilbert Smith. Some researchers know a lot about him. Wilbert Smith was fascinated by UFOs, and back in 1950, really early on, he was in Washington, D.C. at the Canadian Embassy, and he got a meeting with a top-level U.S. scientist in a conversation about the flying saucers that were then being discussed. for a long, long time, no one knew the name of this scientist, but during the 1980s, it was discovered. The scientist's name was Robert Sarbacher. Long after Smith had died, Sarbacher was still alive, and Sarbacher was found by some researchers. And again, this book covers all of this story. When Sarbacher was found to be questioned about whether he actually spoke with Wilbert Smith, to the great shock of all the researchers involved, Robert Sarbacher said, oh, yes, we did actually talk quite a bit about that. And as a matter of fact, this is like in 1983, as a matter of fact, I heard many, many stories about these other beings and about crash retrievals. And, I mean, this isn't just some guy off the street. Robert Sarbacher was a heavy hitter, one of the top power scientists in the U.S. establishment. So this book, among many other fascinating things, covers this whole Smith and Sarbacher saga, which is incredible. But it really focuses in on a fellow named Dr. Eric A. Walker, who Sarbacher led the researchers to this man. Eric Walker was president of Penn State University for many years, but he was much, much more than that. He was a very good friend of President Dwight Eisenhower. He was head of what was known as the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, maybe the top military think tank in the country. Walker was powerful. Sarbacher led researchers to Walker, and then Grant and Scott and several other researchers began having discussions with Eric Walker. And Walker started to talk. And it's a series of fascinating interviews that are recreated in this book. And it doesn't get old reading it. Every time I read it, it just blows me away.
It's cat and mouse kind of. It's an intrigue. You know, field is it's so weird. You've got spies and lies and disinformation. It's always hard to figure out what's solid and what isn't. And we know that some of the whistleblowers who've come forward are liars, especially in the Roswell case. Some of those guys were completely making stuff up. The same thing happened in the Area 51 state. So the difficulty for people like you and Grant is to figure out who's worth following and who isn't.
Well, I think you said it for sure. And in the case of Eric Walker, he did play. He was really coy at times. But the impression that I've gotten when I've gone over all of the transcripts is that Walker was caught a bit off guard. Because keep in mind, when he started talking, the MJ-12 documents were a brand new event. This is 1987 when they really came out. And Walker was informed that his colleague, Dr. Robert Sarbacher, had been talking. MJ-12 is out. And what it appears, if you really read through these transcripts, is that Walker initially said way more than he probably should have said. And that's what really got this whole thing started. That's my take on it. Your point is very well taken. You never really know. And you say something, then you pull it back, and then you say something else, and you pull it back. And this, by the way, is a very important concept that Grant and Scott bring up in this book. And I'm sure Grant will talk about it, but the idea of a limited hangout. And I think this is the theme that really informs the entire book, which is very simple. If you're on the inside and you've got this big truth that you want to get out, if you think that at some point some of it needs to get out, and there are people, I think, on the inside who feel this way, the question becomes, how do you do it? How do you do it without destabilizing the whole system? You throw a little bit of truth out there, but then you run away from that truth and deny it so that it doesn't cause the whole apple cart to come crashing down all at once. And as a matter of fact, what Grant has in this book is a long statement by Dr. Christopher Green, Kit Green, exactly to that effect. And no one knows, Kit Green was a top-level CIA consultant, scientist for many, many years, had given briefings to President Ronald Reagan, knows many, many other very high-level people in the national security community, and speaks in this book at some length about the whole concept of this limited disclosure, limited hangout.
Bottom line, after you read this book, you know, so many of the skeptics, I should call them debunkers instead, they're not going to believe it regardless. You could have the proverbial landing on the White House lawn and they wouldn't believe it. But any reasonably intelligent person who reads this stuff, you would have to say that these statements from these heavy hitters constitute proof.
Yeah, I mean, for me it does. I would say it constitutes very, very powerful evidence, and maybe that's the most careful way I would want to put
evidence,
it.
Evidence, yes.
Absolutely a powerful statement. I'm very proud of this book, and, you know, as the publisher of it, I went through every single page of it over and over many, many times, did a lot of editing of it. The research was never a problem. The writing was always good, but I really wanted this book to shine, and I'm so happy about it. This book will be available starting tomorrow. I wanted it to be available tonight, but unfortunately, it's just one of these things about publishing, but it will be available by a link at keyholepublishing.com. I would encourage anyone just to go check it out. I'm 99% sure that link will be live then. They'll be able to get it easily in North America or Europe or UK and elsewhere in the world, but shipping is very, very easy for those regions. This is, in my opinion, a new classic. And I can't tell you how excited I am to be associated with this book. Ed and Scott both are just very professional.
I agree with you. It is classic, and I hope you'll come back and tell us what other projects you've got coming this year. You have an open invitation, Richard.
Well, thank you, George. Well, I have a new book of my own coming out in about 2 months, and I'm very excited about that, but we'll talk about that when it's ready.
I appreciate that. Richard Dolan, thanks for joining us. Grant Cameron, author or co-author of UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, joins us when we come back. Crashes play a big role in what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this program, specifically UFO crashes, allegations about Roswell and other incidents, and the people who may or may not have known the inside truth of what went on. Grant Cameron has spent a big chunk of his life, more than a quarter of a century, tracking down these stories, trying to find, separate wheat from chaff. The UFO field, of course, as listeners to this program know, is filled with people who have wild stories, and some of them prove to be completely bogus. So separating wheat from chaff is often a tough thing to do. It's a steep learning curve. And Grant Cameron, as Richard Dolan just told us, is one of the stars in the UFO field, known for his meticulous work in tracking down truth and figuring out who's telling the truth. And he's this new book is a monumental work. We're going to jump right into it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron and Scott Crane have cranked out a new book called UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. It's taken a long time to put it all together, but it'll be out tomorrow. And it's highly recommended for anybody who considers themselves to be any kind of a serious devotee to the UFO topic, because it really does track down some intriguing leads about the most interesting mysteries, MJ-12 documents, Roswell and other crashes, who's believable and who is not. Grant, it's great to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks, George. It's an honor to be on. I would do part of a book, and then I get to be interviewed by a guy who actually made Area 51 famous, and so it's an honor there. And it's also an honor because over the years, you've been in this a lot of years, and I think the majority of the stories that I sort of deal with, you followed it. You've been sitting on the sidelines watching this whole thing, and so the names and the places and all that stuff is familiar to you, and that's fairly rare to get a reporter who's as well versed on what we're going to be talking about.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of this territory that has a familiar ring, that's for sure, and we'll get into that. There must be an incredible sense of relief for you now to have this thing done after so much time.
It dragged on, and even in the last couple of days, it was sort of like, I guess it happens in research where you're sort of trying to track down different things. Richard would bring up this or that, and you're trying to track it down, and suddenly you find new stuff, and there was actually three or four things that happened in the last day or two that never even made it into the book. It was just like sort of like a waterfall. It just kept going, and finally we had to sort of put an end to it, and we just sort of shut the book down. But there's actually more material that has come out since a couple of days ago when we finally shut it down.
Well, that's the most fun, isn't it, digging up the facts? The writing is hard. It's digging the stuff up that's fun.
Yeah. I'm really not that interested. I always usually try to get a co-author to write up my stuff. That to me, that's the part is whether it's doing lectures or whether it's doing research for a book, that's when you sort of discover things that you really hadn't seen before. And one prime example is like when we were doing the Area 51. This is actually a book that was published in 1991. And in there, we sort of were chasing you around back in 89, 90 when you were breaking the Area 51 story. And we put it out. So when I was redoing the book, I was sort of updating the book from the 1991 version, I was reviewing the Area 51 thing, and I figured, well, it looked pretty good. We seemed to have it. There really nothing's changed over 20 years. And then I started to figure, well, I'll check all the interviews. So I went through some of your interviews with John Lear and Huff and all the various audio interviews that are you can now get on the internet. And suddenly all this new stuff that I, you know, that popped up that I had never known before. And it was almost like a whole rewrite of the chapter. So,
well, that part of it is great. I enjoyed it, and reading it this weekend brought a lot of things back to my mind that I'd forgotten about, details about that wild time. Tell me this. Give me an overview. What you think the impact of the book is? I mean, you look at the statements from some of these heavy hitters that we're going to talk about one by one, things that they say about the reality, what the government knows, and you'd have to say that that constitutes evidence of some sort. Even for skeptics, if you read this stuff and you hear these people and you realize who they were and how credible they were, it has to constitute evidence of something. But evidence of what? What's the big picture now that you've finished the writing?
My big picture of the thing is it comes down to a lot of people. What will happen is in the UFO field, I find that what happens is a story will come out, whether it's the Area 51, the Lazar story, or whether it's the MJ-12 story, and people will sort of look at it, and they'll sort of go along, and then suddenly somebody puts out that it's a hoax, and they find some problem with the story, and everybody just sort of drops the story and races and looks for the next news story or the next video, and all that stuff just sort of gets thrown on the sidelines. And what I found when I went through the whole thing, I've come up with this theory that really, it's not disinformation. Like a lot of people say it's disinformation, like Bill Moore putting this stuff out. What I found that it is that the government has been disclosing this kind of stuff. And so the material that is coming out is not disinformation. It's information that they are providing us. And they're covering it with a bunch of garbage, a bunch of disinformation. And I can give you the prime example to me is, I live in Canada, and in Canada, the Canadians were also involved in UFOs back in the 50s, and they pulled out of the UFO field about the same time as the Americans pulled out of the UFO field. And the Canadians basically said the same thing as the Americans. This is not a threat to national security. There's no credible evidence that ETs have visited the Earth. And the Canadians just sort of packed it in and went away. And I've been at this for 40 years, and I seriously could not tell you whether the Canadian government is involved. There's absolutely no indication of any department. I would have no idea where to file an FOIA in Canada or to try to get any information. In the United States, it's completely different, absolutely different. And to set this up, in 1969, the U.S. Air Force shut down Project Blue Book, and they shut it down right before Christmas when all the reporters had gone home in Washington. They shut it down. It was basically the same thing. No threat to national security, no ETs visiting the Earth, and the story sort of died. And then in 1972, they were in a situation where the PR nightmare was over. They never had to talk about UFOs again. The American government wasn't involved. And then in 1972, they contact Alan Sandler, Bob Emenegger, and I say this is potentially the most important story in ufology because it explains what happened with MJ-12, with Area 51, with Chase Brandon, with all these stories that would come out after 1969 when they shut Blue Book down. They could have just gone and watched NFL football, Dancing with the Stars. They never had to talk about UFOs ever again. So why in 1972 would they contact Sandler, who was a film producer in Los Angeles, and Bob Emenegger, who is vice president of Gray Advertising, and say to them, we want to do some documentaries. They call them Norton Air Force Base, where they keep all the military film. They take them into a clean room, which is a CIA clean room, where the CIA was doing documentary stuff for training films and stuff like that. And they take them in, and here's the government that says, we aren't involved. They're out of it. They don't have to talk about UFOs again. And they say, Paul Schartle, who is the security manager, says to them, we want you to do these documentaries on holography, 3D holography, and working with dolphins and all these different military things, and then said to them, and the other thing we'd like you to work on, but we'd like you to sort of bury it under all these other documentaries, we'd like to do a documentary on UFOs. What would you think if we told you that at 6 a.m. in May of 1971, a flying saucer landed at Holloman Air Force Base, and that aliens got out, were greeted by officials from the Air Force Base, and that it was filmed from three different angles by the U.S. Air Force? Now, the government is not involved. They bring in these guys who are highly credible, and the story that they tell, I say it's the best story. They basically walked into the Pentagon to talk to Bill Coleman. They didn't sign in at the Pentagon. They went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Everybody that they wanted to talk to, they were allowed to talk to. They were allowed to go on Holloman Air Force Base, wander around, do whatever they wanted. They put out this documentary. They were offered this film. They had the film in their possession, this film of this landing. And Paul Schartle went on a documentary later and described what was on the film. And the last minute, they pulled the film back. And so that's the sort of the blueprint of what happens all the way through the next 40 years, is that the government puts the material out. They're telling the true story. They pull it back. People sort of flush it and say, oh, well, it's just a hoax. It's just this or whatever. And they go on to the next story, and yet the story got out. And the whole idea, the whole thing that I say that they're doing, whether it's Emanager, whether it's UFO Cover-Up Live, MJ-12, is that they are putting the material out. They're putting the information out, but they're keeping the cover-up going, because the cover-up they need to be maintained, because there's classified material. There's material, whether it's dealing with mental phenomena, which, of course, the CIA would be very interested in, this ability to control people with your minds that is you see in the UFO stories by abductees, or whether it's the technology that's involved with the flying saucers, that you can fly these things around. So that part they need to be maintained, but there is this sort of split that people want the information out. So they're leaking the information, but they're continuing to keep the cover-up going for the classified aspects of the phenomena that they need to maintain for national security.
Yeah, the significance of that, just to reemphasize it, this guy, Emanager, and his partner, they're not chasing UFOs. They weren't there to ask questions about UFOs. It's the government that foisted this on them, not the other way around.
Yeah, and Bob tells the story numerous times, and I have very good friends with him and his wife, and his wife was very much into it. He said he was like, he couldn't believe when they said this was UFOs. He said, this is nonsense. I mean, my wife is talking about, you know, alien babies and stuff, and suddenly the government is telling me this is for real, and he was just shocked. And they signed a contract. This was not some, you know, rinky-dink thing. They actually signed a contract in the Pentagon to do this, and they were told that they were replacing another film operation out of the Pentagon that had messed up on the Pentagon papers, and I was given the name of the company, and because this company had messed this thing up, they were called in to do this sort of stuff, and they had a CIA agent on the set the entire time that they did this production. They had the MacArthur Foundation, John MacArthur, put up $250,000 to do this documentary, and then at the very last second came in and said, my friends are giving me a hard time. I don't want my name on the credits for this documentary, but you can keep the money. So there was these kind of things. And the more you hear about that story, and for example, they were given a bunch of top secret film. The Holloman Air Force Base film was pulled back, but I can confirm that they still have a top secret film they still have in their possession that was given to them in 1972-73 during that period, that shows a launch out of Vandenberg Air Force Base and UFOs flying around this launch. They had the film. They never handed it back in, and Alan Sandler still has the film. So this is the more you hear about this Holloman story, about this thing that when it started in 1972, the more you realize that they were given incredible amounts of material. And, had Bob Friend go on camera because the CIA guy, Arthur Lundahl, who was running the Weird Desk, said, Bob, I'm still on duty. I can't go on film. But they tell this story that they didn't have to tell about the CIA channeling an alien in 1959. And that story, because I'm a Canadian, I know that because the Canadians were also channeling the same alien. So this is a story that they didn't have to tell. This story was put out. And yet when it comes down to it, it's like it's a documentary. Everybody sort of forgets about it and says, well, you know, it was kind of an interesting documentary. And when you see the depth of the story and what actually happened, you realize that the government is actually trying to put material out.
A slow release, sort of a controlled release over time. They use people, whistleblowers if you want, and they have the option to discredit those whistleblowers and make them look ridiculous. But overall, it seems to be what a lot of people have suspected for a long time, that they're telling the story in tiny bits and pieces over a long period of time.
Sure. I always refer to it like they have a trap door for all these things. I really don't think there's any whistleblowers anymore. I think that everybody who comes out as a whistleblower is working for them. That it's like you get a guy who'll say, oh, I've got secret information, and he calls himself Commander X or Mr. X or something, and everybody in the UFO community sort of figures that this guy is now a whistleblower, and he's running around telling all these stories as if the government can't figure out who he is. I mean, the government can figure out who this guy is in 30 seconds. I mean, they monitor all the email, all the phone conversations. They would know immediately. And so I think that anybody who's running around as a whistleblower is actually somebody who is somebody who is there to hand out material. And there's always a trap door, like with the Lazar thing. It looks good, and then suddenly he's got a bad background. And the thing that really keyed me into that he was part of the same thing, that this was part of the same thing, was when you did the interview with John Lear and Huff, and John Lear talks about the fact that there was three interviews, that Lazar went for three interviews. And in the second they were all technical questions, and he aced it. He knocked it out of the park, except for the first question in the second interview. And the first question in the second interview was, what's your relationship to John Lear, and what do you think about him? And so when you hear that Lazar, in the first interview, before he ever went onto the base, was asked about John Lear, gives you the whole story. They knew that he was in contact with John Lear, and anybody who knows, you were there at the time, you know John Lear was the state director for Nevada, for MUFON. He was in charge of the convention that took place the year after. He had been on the base in 1977, taking a picture of the MiG in front of the hangar, so they knew who he was. He was running around Las Vegas making speeches about aliens and underground bases, and it was the perfect setup. It was like, here's a guy with a bad background that they knew that would fall apart. There's a trap door that when Lazar went public, that it would fall apart. So they get the material. He goes onto the base. He gets all this. He comes back. He immediately tells John Lear. Then he's on the base, and they give him 125 documents. And you know the same, that John, that Lazar was only on the base for a couple of days. If you add up all his hours, he was not there very long. And yet they give him 125 documents on every aspect of UFOs to read. And he runs back, and he tells John Lear the whole thing. And the material is getting out. So then when it comes out, the thing falls apart, and everybody says, oh, Lazar, he's missing two master's degrees. It's all nonsense. And everybody just dumps the story. They run off and chase the next UFO story. And the whole story about Area 51 gets out. And where I think they miscalculated on the Area 51 story was that in majority of them, and I've had lots of these stories, where you get a story and you try to get the thing to go, and you have the three-day news cycle. That the reporter, for example, the Chase Brandon story, Lee Spiegel did it. 3 days, he got 1.5 million hits on the website for that story. But he had to go on to the next story. He had to do another story. He ran off. He did the next story. And the Chase Brandon story, as much as we tried to keep it going, just died. And everybody just forgot about what Chase Brandon had said. In your case with Area 51, as you did this long 6 or 8 month investigation, you started getting more witnesses. You had a lot of high profile in terms of putting the videos out and stuff like that. And they miscalculated. And suddenly you had all the people with the buses going up to Area 51. They had to take more land away to stop people from getting up in the hills and looking down over Area 51. And they just miscalculated. What I think they thought was going to happen with Area 51 is he would go, John Lear would tell the stories. Nobody really believed John Lear because he was talking about aliens eating people and underground bases and all sorts of weird stuff. The idea would get out. The story would die. Everybody would find out about the problems with the story. Nobody would believe John Lear. And the story would get out, and the story would quickly die, and we would get the story out. But they miscalculated what was actually going to happen in terms of your investigation of Area 51.
Well, meaning that they thought I would give up.
Yeah, and it's the same thing if you take a look at, I talk a lot about Pandolfi, who you followed as well. This is the guy that the New York Times calls the top scientist in the CIA in 1996. And he's been dropping all these UFO rumors for years. And how did he do it? He's putting it through Dan Smith. So whenever I talk about him, I talk about Dan Smith, and people immediately, it's the same as John Lear or Lazar, is to say, oh, Dan Smith, the guy's a drunk. He gets thrown off of chat boards. He's a totally crazy guy. You can't believe anything Dan Smith's saying. And that's where they have the trap doors. You're putting stuff out right there through bad channels.
Well, we'll come back. Grant, yep, that music tells us we need to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll jump into the Area 51 story, Lear and Lazar, and later get into some other whistleblowers who were reluctantly came forward with stories. We're talking with Grant Cameron, co-author, along with Scott Crane, of this new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. The book comes out tomorrow. Highly recommended. It sort of traces the history of UFO disinformation and the leaking of secrets that lead from MJ-12 and the Roswell crash all the way up to Area 51, involving some very colorful characters, and many of whom I know pretty well. We're going to trace sort of the history of UFO whistleblowers in this hour, and might just have a surprise guest as well. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron, let's jump back in time, sort of at the start of the whistleblower phenomenon in the UFO field. A couple of names that are well known to you and to UFO researchers, but not widely known, at least for the public. Those names are Wilbert Smith and Robert Sarbacher. Tell me who those people were and what they had to say.
Okay, maybe I'll give you some background on how I discovered this guy, because it came sort of as an accident. I had a number of sightings in 1975. My father worked for the Department of Transport in Canada, and one of the people in his office had had a sighting in the area. There was a huge flap of sightings just north of the American border. And this guy had had a sighting, so my father put me in contact with the guy, and I talked to him, and he told me a sighting. It was really, I can't even remember what it was nothing unusual. And then he said, well, you know, if you really want to know what happened with UFOs, you should study Wilbert Smith, who ran the Canadian government UFO program. And I said, well, I've never heard of him. And he said, well, I used to work for him. And the guy was crazy, man. He was the smartest guy I ever met, but he was kind of crazy. He was talking to the aliens, and he believed that the government was in contact, and this was all for real. So I went to track this down, and I talked to his wife. He had died in 1962, and put together all his files and all his lectures and all this sort of stuff. And basically what it came down to is he was a radio engineer, senior radio engineer with the Canadian government, the Department of Transport. And in 1950, he became interested because there was two books. There was the crash saucer, the Aztec crash saucer book that had come out in the United States, and Major Kehoe had put out a book in the United States on flying saucers. He'd become interested, and he was negotiating FM radio frequencies with the Americans. That was part of his job, was to negotiate. So he was down in Washington quite often. He was down, and he started to ask some questions about flying saucers through the Canadian embassy. He had a number of contacts there. And the Canadian embassy put him in contact with Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who was a research troubleshooter for various agencies, defense agencies and stuff like that. And Sarbacher told him that, yes, flying saucers for real. There was a crash in the West, that stuff was recovered, and that there was a series of briefings for this crash flying saucer stuff that had taken place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And so Wilbur Smith goes back to Canada, and he writes what's called the top secret memo. It's been verified as being a legitimate document. It was declassified finally in 1978. And in that document, Smith talks about the fact that he talked to high-ranking officials in the United States, and that he was able to confirm that it was flying saucers were real. He never used the word UFO. I think he knew why the U.S. Air Force developed the term UFOs. He never used the word UFO. He always called them flying saucers. He said flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. And there's a small group headed by Vannevar Bush that's trying to figure out what's going on, and that the American government considers this of extreme significance. And then he says, in the very next line, he says, I've also was told by American officials that mental phenomena might be associated with the saucers. And this is long before any abductees came out and talked about telepathy or contactees. So he writes this top secret memo, and from Dr. Robert Sarbacher, And it becomes public in 1983. This sort of unfolds, and Stanton Friedman gets a hold of this. And Stanton Friedman tracks down Dr. Robert Sarbacher. And so Sarbacher is in Florida at the time. He's still alive. And Stanton's asking him, well, what about these briefings? You said that there was these briefings that took place on this crash flying saucer that took place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and all these top scientists from Washington had gone to these briefings. And Sarbacher said, well, I was busy. I couldn't go. And he named off Vannevar Bush, who was sort of the technological czar during World War II, all the developments of the atomic bomb and the proximity fuse and plastic explosives, jet engines, all that was Vannevar Bush was in charge of all that. So he said, well, Stanton says, well, he's dead. And then he said, well, Von Braun, Stanton said, well, he's dead. And he's naming off one person after another. And Stanton says, well, isn't there anybody who might still be alive? And he said, well, there was this one guy from Pennsylvania. He was a real arrogant guy. He really thought he knew everything. He went to all the briefings. And what would happen is these guys would come back, according to Sarbacher, to the Navy office in Washington, and they would just be standing around talking in the Navy office about what had happened at these briefings. And Sarbacher just overheard these conversations. So the number of people did some work, and a guy by the name of Bill Steinman, a researcher out of California who's long since left the field, figured out it was Dr. Eric Walker. And Eric Walker, if you look him up in Hughes, who he's dead now, but had one of the most impressive biographies you've ever seen. He was chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was the top military think tank for the Department of Defense. And that's where DARPA came out of, the DARPA came out of there. He had 14 honorary doctorate degrees. He was president at Penn State University. He was friends with Eisenhower. He'd done a study on engineering education for Eisenhower. He was friends with Eisenhower's brother, who was the president at Penn State before him, who had nominated him as the president. Just incredible background on this guy. And had known good friends with Vannevar Bush, had been executive secretary of the Research and Development Board, which was developed all the weapons in 1950. He was in the Pentagon. And so anyway, we track him down, and Bill Steinman phones him. And this starts with the whole chapter of the book. Bill Steinman phones him, and he says, I've got a document here. But first he says, I understand that you were at a set of briefings that were given at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base on crash flying saucers and the recovery of extraterrestrial bodies. And Walker says to him, I was there, so what? And then Simon freaks out. He says, what do you mean? This is the most important thing. And he just sort of loses it. And then Walker says, what's the big deal? He says, leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. Research something else. You're up against the windmills. And so this started a thing that went on for about, I guess it went on for about 8 years, maybe a little bit longer. And what I was sort of coordinating a bunch of researchers. So there was Bill Steinman from California. There was Scott Crane, who lived right outside Penn State. There was a researcher from Toronto, Canada. There was a Maine researcher in Britain who did most of the interviews. And basically, we said, this guy knows. He knows how it all unfolded. He was there in 1947, friends with Vannevar Bush. He knows the whole thing. Because Steinman asked him about the MJ-12 document. And this is in 1987, this interview takes place. And he says, I've got this document, this MJ, it's called the MJ-12 document. And Walker cuts him off and he says, I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. Research something else. And so 87, he says, I've known of them, MJ-12, for 40 years. And so that would put it 1947. So when the MJ-12 documents broke in 1987, when Bill Moore, Jamie Chandray released them, I immediately saw it differently than everybody else. Everybody else looked at it and says, well, you know, we think Moore hoaxed them. It doesn't look right. The headings aren't right. I immediately believed that MJ-12 was for real. I didn't know about the document, but I knew MJ-12 was for real because I knew about this conversation with Walker, that Walker said, I've known of them for 40 years. And Steinman didn't mention the fact that it was a group. Walker immediately picked up and knew what he was talking about when he said MJ-12. So that started this thing where people would phone him and they'd try to get him to talk. And it was a conversation where he couldn't hang up the phone. And what he would try to talk around the subject, and people would ask him various questions. He would always reply to people's letters, and he would put things on the bottom of the letter, just sort of hinting at what was going on. And this went on for about 8 years. And then what happened when we released the book in 1991 was we figured we'd broken the UFO cover-up. I figured this is over. This guy is so prominent. He's so public that when people find out that what this guy said, and he basically told us there'd been communication with aliens, and he told us MJ-12 was for real. It was more than 12 people. It's an international group. He confirmed a lot of stuff over these 8 years of conversations with these different researchers. And what happened, for the first time, he hung up the phone. The reporter from Penn State, from the big magazine on the campus, went to interview him, or phoned him to interview him about the book. And he said, I deny it. None of it's true. I'm busy. Sorry. And he hung up the phone. So I talked to Scott Crane, who actually drafted the first manuscript. It was my research, and he wrote up the book. And I said, Scott, when is she going back to interview him again? And he said, she's not. They were so intimidated by this guy. He was so powerful that everybody was afraid to interview the guy. So basically the story died, and I was so frustrated that this big story had come out, and MUFON had published, it was the first book that MUFON published, that I basically quit the field. I figured, like, this is nonsense. I mean, if people aren't going to grab onto this, if this story isn't going to break the cover-up, then nothing's going to break the cover-up. And then I sort of got back into it a number of years later and got into the president's. But this was an incredibly interesting story that we tell the whole story. And when it came down to it, Scott said, well, let's sort of edit the interviews, put what's the good stuff. I said, no, let's just put everything that he said unedited. And some of the stuff is kind of weird, where he says, leave me alone, I'm going on the spacecraft. He would write some crazy letters. But we just said, let's put it out and just say exactly what this guy told us, everything, and who interviewed him. And that's basically the story that led, and then he led to the presence, because what he had said was his files from the when he was doing the weapons at the Pentagon, he had been talking to the Truman Library, that he was going to give them to the Truman Library. And that's when I got into the presence. I figured, well, I got to get these records, Walker's records. So I went to the Truman Library. And they had a few letters, but they really didn't have this set of files that he had sort of promised them. And then I figured, well, you know, it's the most important subject in the world, or one of the most important subjects in the world. This is the most powerful guy in the world. And it was at that point that I was at the Truman Library, and I said, well, what have you got on UFOs for the president? And they had, like, a couple of documents, and I thought, there's something wrong here. I mean, this is this powerful subject. This president has to know what's going on. And then I went about 80 miles down the road to the Eisenhower Library, and I asked them the same thing, and they had five documents. They had 28 million pages of files. They had five documents on UFOs, and it was like nothing. It was like one was a telegram, one was the Robertson panel report, but most of it was just junk. And I'm thinking, five documents out of 28 million pages? And it was at that point that I started to chase to see what the presidents knew and believed that even that was covered up, that the president had to know. And yet, if you go to presidential libraries, you'll think nothing happened, that UFOs absolutely don't exist. So that's basically the story of how it sort of, and it was just one thing led to another, and another person, and it all fit together. We didn't really have to invent anything. Everybody just squealed on the next guy, and the next guy would confirm, and that led us to the majority of what's in this book is this story of Dr. Eric Walker and what he said about MJ-12 and about how the thing worked. And because of the incredible background that he had, I think it carries an awful lot of weight.
Well, Wilbert Smith, who's high up in the Canadian government, takes an interest in UFOs, finds out from colleagues in Washington that Washington takes it seriously, that there have been high-level meetings about crash saucers, recovered material, recovered bodies. That leads to Robert Sarbacher, and we'll come back to him later, but he was a real heavyweight who had way up in scientific and government circles with high-level security clearances. He leads you to Eric Walker, and then a whole series of events happened in the 80s that now, looking back on it, sort of makes sense. Bill Moore comes out in 1989 here in Las Vegas and says, I've been working for the government, working on the inside, feeding out information that may or may not be true to learn what I could. Linda Howe gets the same kind of offer that Emenegger was given. A guy named Richard Doty says, we've got this film, and we're going to show it to you, and we're going to tell you about cattle mutilations. All kinds of information of one degree of credibility or another is being offered, and then, as you mentioned, pulled back. The MJ-12 documents come out, which have a lot of the same names that you've already corroborated independently as being involved with secret UFO studies. And then the Area 51 story hits the fan. John Lear meets Bob Lazar, Lazar gets hired out there at the base, is shown all this material. I mean, people looking back on it would have to say, gosh, that doesn't make sense. And in fact, that is the criticism that people make of Bob Lazar. Well, gosh, they would never hire a guy like him to work there. He can't prove his background. Why would they show him material before he even has a security clearance finalized? It, for a lot of folks, it's hard to swallow. But looking at it in a different, bigger picture, it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely does make sense with the Lazar thing. And what I sort of looked at when I reviewed the Lazar thing is I knew that he'd passed the four lie detectors. I knew that you were telling the truth. I know John Lear. John Lear can say some weird things, but John Lear is as straight a shooter as you can get. He does not make up stuff. He's just basically told his part of the Area 51 story. And so I figured there had to be a way to put this all together. Everybody's telling the truth. There's got to be an answer. And when you looked at it, and when I discovered this thing that Huff had said that Lazar was, part of his job was to report on John Lear, and that they knew about John Lear before he ever put him on the base. Why would they put him on the base when they knew he was in contact with John Lear? It all made sense. And then you could understand why Lazar was put up there, why he was showing all this stuff right from the word go, why he was told when the tests were, because it was pretty well confirmed that they did go up to the site and they did see this thing flying around exactly when Lazar said it was. It all made sense that this guy who really wasn't up on the test site that much was given all this material, and how it ended up where it fell apart and the story got out. And I think that's what they wanted. And they probably had to move the material to another site or whatever because, you know, it all sort of fell apart and got out of control. But they managed to get it back under control. And now you're in a 20 years later, everybody's the same thing. It's like, well, it was just a hoax, you know. And then when I bring up the fact, I said, well, do you know that George Knapp has 24 plus extra witnesses? Well, I didn't know that. And I said, well, you got to know the whole story. When you start looking at it and you look at it in depth, you know that this is for real. This actually did happen, and that you have to be able to explain what happened to Lazar, knowing that what happened on the base is probably true.
You know, I've got to know Bob Lazar pretty well over the last 24 years, and I know various people have their opinions of him, but I don't. I think that he was not a witting dupe. He wasn't working for the government in a witting way, meaning that he knew he was part of a disinformation program. He has, we've had the conversation several times that the possibility that what he was fed for a reason, that he was shown things for a reason to let it out. I just think that they made a terrible miscalculation, as you said, that it would all go away. But it was, if that was the plan, to plant a false flag or put out false info and then pull it back, it was a terrible mistake because to this day the buses are still going up. Every single day there's somebody out in the desert with binoculars watching whatever it is that's going along out there, whatever they're flying, and it's caused terrible problems for them.
Yeah, it is. It has become one of the most famous places in the world. I did some Google searching, and if you Google search it versus the pyramids of Egypt or the Great Wall of China, it has more hits. It is one of the most famous places in the world, and thanks to the work that you and Bob Lazar and John Lear and he kept the story going, and it's just a story that took fire and raced around the world.
Well, you know, people say because Bob can't verify his educational credentials, the whole thing, they throw it out. They'd never hire a guy like him. And I've always contended he would be the most qualified guy. If that's your plan to begin with, to put out the information and then yank it back, you need somebody who's qualified technically, a brilliant guy, scientifically trained, who had worked on classified programs, but who had a lot of crazy stuff in his personal life that could be used to discredit him. And in a sense, he might have been the most qualified person if this was your plan from the beginning.
Sure, because that's the whole thing. If you want disclosure, if people have the idea that they're actually going to release something that's for real, then you just go to the Washington Post, the New York Times, to their Washington reporter. But if you want it to come out in a way that it's coming out now where you can pull it back, you have to give it to somebody who doesn't have any credibility. So that's the whole thing. And even Jacques Vallée had talked about this disinformation thing, and he was involved in a lot of these things through the years. And he said, something does not make much sense here. Why would someone in Washington mount a disinformation effort if the only result was to confuse members of the UFO research community, which is a very small group without much influence in the public at large? So it's something they're doing, and they're getting it out, and they're using these sort of less than credible characters to get the material out. If you really want it out, I don't believe that they're trying to do disclosure, because if they wanted disclosure, they know exactly which reporter to go to get it out. They just wanted to come out in bits and pieces.
Well, Grant Cameron, we're talking about your new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. A key player in the book, who's mentioned many times, is John Lear. I know he's listening tonight. We're going to see if we can get him on the phone and have him join us for a couple of minutes, if that's okay with you.
Beautiful. Love
okay.
to hear him.
Well, we'll see if we'll get him on when we come back.
If you have an opposing view to tonight's program, we invite you to contact us. Please email your comments to webmaster@coasttocoastam.com.
Faux Field for a long time and who lives right down the street from me. John, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, George. Grant Cameron is the best. You know, he always keeps me up to date. He came, drove down here from Canada to interview me many years ago, and then has always kept me up to date and passed on the stuff that he's going to print, ask him, are there any changes? How can we verify this? How can we verify that? This is a really good book for somebody who wants to know about Area 51.
What do you think about the general thesis, the idea of a controlled release, the government giving out a little bit of info and then yanking it back, and the idea that maybe you and I and Bob Lazar, Gene Huff, we were all sort of used in putting this stuff out?
Absolutely true. I heard the other day somebody who was talking with the current head of MJ-12, and I forget what his name is. He's a Navy admiral, and he claims now that that it was his decision to bring Lazar up there.
Your opinion of Bob knowing about this? I mean, he thought he was being shown this. Would you agree that that Bob was not a knowing participant in some sort of a pulling the wool over the public's eyes?
No, he didn't. He didn't know that.
Talk about those days, John. I mean, that was a wild time, and people who weren't around to see it, I think they formed their opinion, well, Bob's a liar, and he didn't go to certain schools, and therefore the whole thing is a bunch of baloney, and the story will go away. I mean, do you agree that that might have been the idea to begin with, that he could be discredited? Well, do you think that there was a plan to begin with in putting out this story that let's pick Bob Lazar, he's a smart guy, we'll show him this stuff, and then we'll discredit him later on?
Absolutely, that's what I believe. Everything fits with a lot of the other people, just as Grant Cameron is saying. But let me ask you this. Is today April Fool's? April Fool's Day?
No.
Okay, just want to check, because the last interview I did on C2C, I ended this three-hour interview, and the host said, by the way, I want you all to remember this is April Fool's Day. But no, this is not April Fool's Day, and what I say is, you know, what I believe.
Well, you've said some controversial things over the years. A lot of them have turned out to be true. Some of them we're still waiting.
And speaking of that, Bob Lazar was over this afternoon, and great as guy as he is, and all the things I've tried to tell him, he will flat not believe that millions of people live on the moon. Now, how can I deal with a guy like that? I mean, here I tried to tell him that that flying saucers is real. No, he didn't believe that. Now he found out that was true. And then I told him there was water on the moon, and no, he couldn't believe that. Now we found out that's true, and he says, well, that was a one-in-a-million deal. So how many more one-in-a-million deals do I got to come up with to make him believe me?
Grant, in your dealings with John, I mean, you have to look back on this story, and I can see why people that have trouble believing it, in part because of the nature of their relationship and how they met. I mean, I think people have a hard time believing it was just accidental.
Yeah, with the doing the house thing, yeah, that was it was kind of weird, but it always came back to me to John, that John is as honest as the day is long, and he may be right or wrong about something, but he's saying what he actually believes, and he's not afraid to say it. And so if John says that's the way it happened, I think that's the way it happened, that John is absolutely truthful, and Lazar passed the lie detector test, and I have no reason to doubt you. And that's the basis of the whole thing, was that everybody was telling the truth as they knew it. They may have been deceived or, you know, not know what was going on. But you know, I think it, the story, the way it was told, is basically the way it happened.
Grant, you are the best.
John, looking back on those days, I mean, as Grant mentioned, one of the things that jumped out at him in this story is that Bob was asked about you in one of his in his second interview. Do you know John Lear? And it surely indicates that they were what you always assumed they
Absolutely.
Were doing is watching you and listening to your phones.
Yeah, they said, "What do you know about John Lear?" And he said, "He's talking to me, Bob, telling me the story." And he says, "I told him that I thought he stuck his nose in places that it didn't belong." And he said to me, "What he didn't tell them was he also likes to stick his nose into places that it doesn't belong."
But you and he, when you were speaking back in those days, always operated under the assumption that somebody is listening on the phones and maybe watching your house?
Yeah, and I had teenager daughters who were always having their phone worked on, changing this line, changing that line, changing room to room. And this guy up from Centel came in one day, and this is like 1987, said, "John, your phone is tapped. Do you know that?" And I said, "Well, no, but I would assume it's tapped." He said, "Do you want me to find out where the tap is?" And I said, "Well, that'd be kind of fun." So he came back an hour later, and he said, "Well, I've gone down Monroe, down Hollywood, down Bonanza to Nellis, and it's further than that." I said, "Well, okay, no problem." He says, "You know, I'd like to find out." So he says, "I'll get back with you." So the next morning he shows up at my door. He says, "John, I can't work on your phones anymore." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, I found out there's a tap on your phone at the mainframe, but it doesn't have any paperwork." So I went to tell my boss about it, and she said, "If you don't like your job, quit." So he says, "I like my job, so I'm not going to be working on your phones anymore."
You know, we our general theme about whistleblowers, I think you're an example of it, John. You took an interest in UFOs. There are those who say that whistleblowers have nothing to fear, but you paid a price for it, didn't you?
Yeah, I was a senior captain with American Transair, who is now out of business. But I had a good thing going there, and one day I was called in the summer of 89, and they held up this article that was out of the Houston Chronicle, and I gave the interview on the specific promise that he would not mention my name. But, of course, there it is in the first line. It said, "John Lear, senior captain with American Transair." And, of course, it didn't take a couple hours before that reached headquarters, and they asked me to come back there, and they held up the article and said, "Is this true?" And I said, or, you know, the headline, whatever it was, "Flying Saucers Are Real." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you know, we can't have anybody flying our Lockheed L-1011 with passengers who believes in UFOs. So goodbye." And it was over in 20 minutes. They, you know, yanked my ID, my credit cards, and gave me a ticket home, and that was it.
Do you believe that Lazar was hired to work out there because, at least in part, as crazy as it sounds, because he knew you and they figured he would leak stuff to you?
Yeah, that's what I believe.
Were you surprised back in those days that Bob was so free with the information?
Yeah, the first thing I told him is when he came up that day and sat right in front of me like he usually did, I'm writing stuff onto my desk, and he just casually says, "I saw a disc today." And I looked up, I said, "What?" And he said, "I saw a disc today." And I said, "Theirs or ours?" He said, "Theirs." I said, "You went to Groom Lake?" And he said, "Yep." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here? Why don't you just work for a couple months, find out what's going on, and then tell us?" He said, I am telling you this because over the last 6 months, I've seen so much crap given you that I had to tell you it's true. I saw it, I touched it, and it's real.
You know, back in those days, there were so many strange things going on, Grant, as you've learned. For a lot of people, they look at Bob Lazar's story and they say it can't be true because there's no evidence he ever went to the schools that he claimed. And I know Stanton Friedman and a couple of others have taken the step of doing the research themselves and found out that there are no records to verify it. And for them, that closes the door. I would like to remind people that that part of the story was in the very first report we ever made. It wasn't like somebody researched the Bob Lazar's claims and went, "Aha, he's a liar. He didn't go to these schools." We reported it in the very first story that aired where we identified Bob. And it was it is a problem. It has been a problem. But if their intention was to hire somebody that can be discredited, it perfectly fit.
Yeah, who else told us about 115? You know, a lot of the stuff he came out with, nobody else has come with it since then.
And Grant,
one of the things I would like to add to this background thing is a lot of people bring this up, and I say, okay, I'll concede there's a problem with the background. What else do you say was wrong? And that's it. That's as far as it goes. Nobody else has anything else. They always bring up the background, the degrees and stuff like that. And then I say, well, he passed all the lie detector tests. How do you explain that? And that's basically what it all falls back on, is this one thing about his background, but everything else checks. Like, for example, John will confirm that, you know, if he wasn't there, how did he know when the test was? Because John stated quite clearly that exactly when he said that thing would come over the mountains, it came over the mountains. And
yeah,
they had it on film. So, I mean, you can't deny that kind of stuff.
And he told me that a day before, and I said, okay, how do you explain that? And, of course, some people say, well, maybe he was a cook. Okay, so he's a cook. You mean they showed the cook when all the classified UFO tests are being held?
Well, there are a lot of things like that that if you want to not believe the story, that you'll skip over. But it's not only that he knew when and where the tests were taking place. He knew that there was a place called S4. That hadn't been published. He knew about this agent, Mike Thigpen, who did background checks for an obscure agency called the OFI, which in fact does do background checks for security purposes at the test site in Area 51. I knew a lot of stuff that he couldn't have known otherwise, that if you don't want to believe it, you just skip over it. And Grant, I guess that presents problems for somebody like you in separating wheat from chaff, but it's hard to disregard.
Yeah. But then I came to this conclusion that there was something going on, that they wanted it out. And once I got the idea that if they could find somebody who had something, like, for example, if his background was bad, they knew it. When he was at Los Alamos, they knew it. When he got interviewed, they knew the whole thing. I mean, it wasn't like it became as a surprise after he was there that they didn't know. I mean, they surely would have known what his background was. And so if they put him up there, and everything points to the fact that he was there. There was so many things that prove that he was there. And, your people that you confirm parts of his story and stuff like that. And when you got that, and then to me it was always John Lear was the focus, that John Lear was very prominent in his background, his father. He was giving lectures at the time, and he was very, very prominent in Las Vegas. I think he'd even given a lecture to the former intelligence officers or something during that period of time. So that was what made it all fit, is that you needed that environment to get it out and then to be able to control it. And unfortunately, with the Area 51 thing, it sort of got out of control.
But, George, in answer to your question, that was the most exciting time of my life, those 3 years from the summer that I met Bob. That would have been the summer of 88. The next 3 years, I mean, it was just unbelievable stuff going on, and just all kinds of stuff was happening.
Yeah, and so, a lot of people don't realize, like, you had the people with the phone taps and stuff, and a lot of stuff people don't realize is that George had the same thing with the witnesses that he would have these witnesses ready to testify, and then suddenly they'd get a visit, and they would suddenly disappear. They couldn't do the interview. And a lot of that stuff, when people, and that's what we've got in the book, is we tell these parts of the story that people haven't heard, that people who are skeptical about Area 51 don't know that kind of stuff, that it wasn't just Lazar, it was all the stuff that was happening to John Lear, it was the stuff that was happening to Huff, it was the stuff that was happening to George Knapp. And when you put it all together, it gets very hard to try to explain this as just some hoax that was carried off by Bob Lazar.
Right.
But you'd have to agree, both of you, Grant, you first and then John, that it's so convoluted in some ways. The story is so hard to follow, not only about Lazar and Lear and Area 51, but all the stuff leading up to it. It's such a steep learning curve. It's easy for people to say, I'm not going to wade through this. It's too hard to follow it, to find the nuggets of truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. In the UFO community, that is a problem. We have this cycle that people take a quick look at it, like this latest story, this Medvedev thing in the Soviet Union. He comes out, he says, okay, we get briefed. And he says this to one of the top reporters in Russia. And the story broke, And I'm immediately, we've got to talk to the reporter. We've got to follow this. I've been waiting for this for years. And everybody just said, oh, I think he's kidding. And they go on to the next story. And you could not convince these people to go back and take a look at it. You know, like, who cares whether you think he's you know, making it up or not making it up. Let's go after this story. Let's try to get something on this story. But you couldn't convince people. They just make up their mind. It's true, it's not true, and they just go on to the next story without really doing any research.
And another thing they do is they keep track of the writers for various magazines and newspapers who have shown the slightest interest in this. And George and I had a very good friend, Ned Day, who passed away many years ago, but he was a reporter, and he worked for KLAS. And he had done some stories for me and on my gun business, some other stuff I had. And so when I got pretty much what I thought I needed to wrap this story up, to give it to somebody, to air it or something, I went to talk to Ned Day. And I can remember that day I walked in the studio and we're sitting down and I'm giving this the whole thing to Ned Day. And he says, well, John, this can't be, because if it was going on, I would have known it. Now, I can imagine a guy for a local TV station, he would have known there was, you know, a classified project on UFOs. Fortunately for me, George was walking by and heard this conversation. And as I was walking out the door, he said, John, just a second, would you mind telling me the story? And that's how the whole thing started. If it hadn't been for George walking by at that single instant, and heard the last words that Ned Day said, you know, if it was going on, I would have known it. none of this would happen.
John, one more question for you, and we appreciate you coming on. Do you agree that somebody miscalculated with this whole thing, that they wanted to put it out, let's run it up the flagpole, see how the public reacts, then pull it back, that they made a terrible miscalculation of how interested the public would be? Because here we are, 24 years later, still talking about it, and people are still out there looking at the base.
Yeah, that is the straight story on that, because there's so many things we have secret stuff that we have that's 50 years ahead of where anybody would believe, and the story, the so-called disclosure, is not going to happen for another two or three decades, because supposedly that's when the ETs, want it to happen.
Do you have any idea, John, where they might have moved the hardware? Primary 51,
there,
I assume.
But if they moved it, it's at that secret base. It's 40 miles south of Wendover. It's on the Ferber, I think that's F-E-R-B-E-R, flats. And I get that information from a deer hunter who was hunting in that area and was almost tracked down by the camo dudes, and he got away. And then another guy who, my other source, is a guy who worked there. And that particular place is hidden by holography. And what they do is they project an image above the base that makes it just look like in that area. It's desert land and some shrub brush and everything. So if you go on Google Earth and look on Ferber Flats, that's where it is.
John, I want to thank you for, I know you haven't been feeling well, but we wish you well, and thank you for joining us tonight. I look forward to seeing this film that's in the making, a guy named Jeremy Corbell making a film about your life and your research, and I've seen little snippets of it, looking forward to seeing it so much. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, outstanding, George. Thanks.
All right, talk to you later. And we'll be back with more, lots more to cover with Grant Cameron. We barely scratched the surface, but we'll get to as much of it as we can, then open up the phone lines a little bit later with your questions here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Grant Cameron, co-author of the new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, and the whole concept of disinformation, that our government would put out phony stories about UFOs and crashed saucers. Might seem ridiculous to the uninitiated, but Grant Cameron thinks there's plenty of evidence that that's exactly what happened. We'll be going down a laundry list of some of the other names and figures who are mentioned prominently in his book, and then open up the phone lines with your questions here on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron, let's cover some ground here. Speak to me in general about the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA. It was created in the 70s there, and it changed a lot of things. I remember, you know, you look back at the requests that researchers like yourself have made prior to its existence. You ask the FBI or CIA for their UFO documents, and they say we don't have any. Then FOIA becomes the law of the land, and they're forced to release thousands of pages of information. Do you think that the stuff they were forced to release is real, or it's bogus and altered?
It's real. All the other documents are phony, which we can get into in a minute, but all the FOIA stuff is real. And I think about half of all the UFO documents that we have in our possession all came out during the Carter administration, and that's because Carter had forced it. He basically said, we're going to follow the law, we're going to do this. He wanted those as well, so he was trying to flesh it out. And Kit Green, who was a former CIA analyst at the CIA, who was responsible for handing out the CIA UFO files, talked about this sort of like sort of a war inside the CIA to try to avoid this FOIA. And he talks about this girl who was in charge who came and came into his office crying, and how he had some of his private UFO material were there, and this sort of got tied up in the FOIA, and he was sort of reprimanded, like, why did you bring this stuff into work? Get this stuff out of here. And he talked about this sort of like a real panic mode. But I think they've sort of learned to walk around it. For example, if you file an FOIA with the CIA, they'll always play the you're going to pay for it. You know, how much are you willing to pay? And it's going to take, you know, X number of hours at, you know, piles of money. And vast majority of people just walk away from it. Now, I've gotten lucky a couple of times. I got the when I filed FOIA with the Clinton administration, because the rumor was that Clinton was very interested. And I managed to get, by following Bruce McAbee, who had filed an FOIA, I filed the same FOIA, and I got twice as much as he did. I got 1,000 pages. And this detailed the Rockefeller Initiative from the Clinton administration, where Rockefeller went to the Clintons and were trying to force. And these are, like, really interesting documents. It's not like, you know, stuff that just citing reports and stuff. This is actual, you know, memos going back and forth between people in the White House and Rockefeller's people, and very interesting stuff. The thing is, when I tried to redo it, because the Clintons went out of office, and then 5 years after the Clintons leave, you can file FOIAs. So I filed 100 FOIAs, knowing who all the people in the administration were, and so the Clinton library started to release the stuff, and then it went after these 1,000 pages that I'd gotten originally from the Office of the Science Advisor, and I cannot find them. I've gone to the National Archives, and they have basically disappeared, and I send them the actual inventory. Here's the documents, here's the dates, here's the inventory, here's the letters I got, nowhere to be found. So they've sort of learned to walk around the FOIA stuff, and the stuff you get out of there really is not very significant. The real stuff, as most people sort of assume, has been moved into the black world, into off-government stuff. That the stuff that they have, there's always a thing, does the president even know what's going on? There's no doubt that vast majority of people in government have no idea what's going on, that you have to find out. So I've sort of left the FOIA, even though I file, and have gone to try to find out who's actually got it. Not the government, it's somebody else, and going after those type of documents. And that's where you get into the thing about the leaked documents, which a lot of people will say are hoaxed. And I firmly believe that all the documents that have been leaked are all phony, but they're all very, very important. And you go back, you look at a guy that you knew, that I knew, that was Bill Moore, who in the 1980s, nobody really knows who he is anymore, but in the 1980s was probably one of the most prominent researchers with Stanton Friedman in the UFO community. And in 1989, he gave a speech in Las Vegas. It was the last speech he gave. And this is the one where he talked about one document that he knew was phony, that he'd handed off to a guy by the name of Paul Benowitz. And at that point, the place just erupted. People were throwing stuff at him. People were yelling. And nobody really listened to his speech. But in his speech, he basically talked about the fact that he'd been contacted by high-level officials inside the government. And he said something very significant. I'll just read one chapter, one small paragraph to you that explains exactly what's happened. And what Bill Moore says, he talks about the fact that after he released the Roswell book, when Roswell became famous, it was because Bill Moore in 1980 had released this book called The Roswell Incident. And Stanton Friedman helped him break this thing. He had released this book, and about 9 days after he went on his book tour, and this book, I think, sold 1 million copies or whatever, it made Roswell famous. He was contacted by a guy who called himself the Falcon. He was contacted twice. The first time, Bill Moore didn't take the phone call. The second time, he did take the phone call, and he got hooked because the guy said, you're the only guy who knows what you're talking about in ufology. And Bill Moore had an ego. Bill Moore fell for it, and he describes this guy, and this is very important, that he says in this speech in 1989, the last speech he gave, he said, I was approached by a well-placed individual within the intelligence community who claimed that he to be directly contacted with high-level project dealing with UFOs. This individual told me that he spoke for a small group of similar individuals who were uncomfortable with the government's continuing cover-up of the truth and indicated that he and this group would like to help me with my research into the subject and give an in the expectation that I might be able to help them find a way to change the prevailing policy and get the facts to the public. This is important, to get the facts to the public without breaking any laws in the process. And that's the whole key. All the UFO documents that have been leaked have to be phony. The MJ-12 document, is basically phony because we now believe there was a live alien. There wasn't four dead aliens like the document claims. There was a live alien. But the whole idea is you can't break the law. And if you release a classified document, you're going to jail. They're going to get you. And the prime example of that was last year, they went after Obama and the White House because these leaks came out about sabotaging the computers in Iran, the nuclear computers, and about the drones. And they were going after the White House. They were going after Obama for release of classified material. Whether you're the president or whether you're just a researcher in UFOs in the field, if you release classified material, you are going to jail. So what the Falcon, this Falcon guy who is headed this group of people who were talking to Bill Moore, said, we are going to help you, but we can't break the law. And he said, part of what you're going to get is true, part of what you're going to get is not true. You're going to have to sort out what's true and what's not. And so that's the same principle. They're releasing the material in a flood of disinformation because that's the way they have to do it. If you release classified material, you're going to jail. Prime example, again, you come to the Chase Brannon story, which just happened last year. The White House puts out a statement and says UFOs are not it's the first time the White House has actually put out a statement. It's not national security, and there's no evidence of extraterrestrials on the Earth. Suddenly, this Chase Brannon guy, 40 years with the CIA, and for 10 years was second most powerful spokesman inside the CIA who could speak on behalf of the CIA because he's working on this as a liaison to Hollywood. This highly powerful guy comes out and says, oh, by the way, I was at Langley, and I saw this box, and it was had a Roswell on the side, and I looked in the box. I can't tell you what was in the box, but I can confirm to you that what was in the box confirmed to me absolutely that Roswell happened and that there were bodies. And the whole thing that I concluded from that whole thing, this guy would not come out. You cannot come out if you're the CIA, because basically their job is to provide intelligence for the president. You're not going to have some guy come out from the CIA and throw them under the Roswell bus and get away with it. If it's classified material, he's going to jail. And that's why he tells a story that what's in the box, I can't tell you what was in the box. You can do whatever you want. I can't tell you. Because if he identifies a certain photograph, a certain document that's classified material, and he breaks the law. So that's how they do it. They make up this story, I saw a box, and he sort of gets the idea across that Roswell's for real. The 65th anniversary of the Roswell crash, happy birthday, here it is, another leak. And the idea that this guy could come out and do this, for example, if he were to say, I saw a box on the side, it had Bin Laden, and I looked inside, and I can confirm to you that I saw that Bin Laden had been killed at Tora Bora in 2000, the story would have been everywhere. The president would have been drawn up. The White House would have been answering questions. And because it was a UFO thing, everybody just looked at it, figured, ah, it's just another UFO story, and went on and did something else. It was a high-level guy putting this out. And Bill Moore had all these high-level people, and some of them, from what we've indicated, what we sort of know now, some of them were former CIA directors, Robert Gates, Helms, Richard Helms. He had some very high-level people who were feeding them this material. But it was all, again, it was phony documents that had real material. And a lot of people said, well, Bill Moore hoaxed it. It was very obvious that Bill Moore didn't hoax it, because Bill Moore left the field in 1989, and anybody who was there at the time knows that in 1990, what were called the new MJ-12 documents started to be leaked. And they, Bob Wood and Ryan Wood, two father-son, were the people that sort of gathered these documents together. I asked them at one point, I said, how many pages are we dealing with here? And they said, over 4,000. 4,000 pages of leaked documents. And they were very sophisticated, because Bob Wood was a high-level guy. He was an engineer with Douglas Aircraft. He was a smart guy, and he was sort of buying into these documents. He was researching them. The idea that you'd have 4,000 documents leaked into the UFO community, this is not Bill Moore. It's not Richard Doty. This is an agency. And the question is, why are they leaking 4,000 pages of documents? They're trying to tell a story. But the documents are all phony. They have to be phony, because you can't release classified information. That's how they're getting the story out.
So releasing the story but muddying the waters, sort of what they did with Falcon and Condor, these guys that showed up on television in 1988, I think. You mentioned that in the book as well.
Yeah, and people will say, like, that's another thing that happened exactly the same time as Lazar. It was October of 1988. Lazar does the interviews and goes up about 6 weeks later up onto the test site. 6 weeks before, you have this UFO cover-up live show that took place. Now, in the book, I only briefly mention it, but it's a way bigger story. If you take a look at that documentary, and at the time it was really hyped, in that documentary you have, for example, they show a flow chart, and it shows on the flow chart, it shows Area 51. This is September of 1988. So this is before you did the story and exposed Area 51. It's on that flow chart. It says Area 51 is part of the UFO thing. It shows the DIA remote viewing program is on that flowchart. That does not become declassified till 1995. It's on that flowchart. They have sort of some pictures of aliens, like drawings of aliens, that when they blew them up and freeze framed the video, there was markings on the bottom which showed that these schematic drawings of aliens had come from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And then there was some that from satellites that were the satellites that supposedly picked up the fast walkers. The satellites were picking up UFOs coming in, and there's freeze frames that show the number of that satellite. So there's all these type of things, and then you take a look at the whole other part. That when I did the research, a story I had back in the 1980s that I never made public until this book came out was the fact that at one point, one of the researchers that broke the Walker story was Bill Steinman. And I knew Bill Steinman very well. And Bill Steinman and Bill Moore were very close friends. They both lived in Los Angeles. And at one point, they were chasing a guy in Albuquerque who had supposedly come from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, was running the program. He had died. Bill Steinman's interviewing his wife. And his wife is saying, Henry Kissinger is the boss. You should be talking to Henry Kissinger. He's the guy that came to my husband. So he's doing this interview, and Bill Moore phones him up the next day, and Bill Moore says, what were you talking to Mrs. Wang for? And Steinman says, well, how do you know I was talking to Mrs. Wang? And he says, I know you were talking, and he starts telling Steinman what was in the conversation. And he said, well, how do you know what we said? It's almost like you were listening in on the phone conversation. And Bill says, okay, come to my place tomorrow, and I'll explain it to you. So Bill goes over to Bill Moore's house, and Bill says, well, I got to tell you, when I was going to university, I was recruited by the CIA. And the CIA came to me, and I did a couple of papers for them. I did a little bit of research for them. And then I went on, became a school teacher, did all the stuff he did. But when I got into UFOs, I reacquainted myself with my contacts inside the CIA. And so here you have a situation where Bill Moore is confirming that he has these contacts, and that's how he got all these high-level contacts. He's basically CIA. And after he left the field, the guy that he brought in, when the MJ-12 documents came out, they didn't get Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman was the best researcher in the field. He helped them work on it. But instead of getting Stanton Friedman to help with all this material that the Falcon was leaking, piles and piles, and these birds were giving him all this material, he picks up Jamie Chandry. And Jamie Chandra was the guy that got the MJ-12 documents in the mailbox. So everybody said, well, this is phony because Jamie Chandra is not even a UFO researcher. Why would they give the documents? Why didn't they mail them to Moore? This is all a setup. It's all Moore. And Moore releases it in an interview he did after he left. He said, well, Chandra was CIA. He'd worked for the CIA. So, of course, here you have Moore CIA, Chandra CIA. You have this UFO cover-up live show that took place just before Lazar goes up, and it was very hyped. And you have Gray Advertising, the producers from Gray Advertising, which Linda Howe will say numerous times, it's a CIA front company. And if you look on the Internet, it's listed as one of the 500 CIA front companies. You have all this stuff was scripted. Everybody had to read from a script. You could not vary from the script. And Bob Emmenegger didn't know who wrote the script. You had Alan Sandler, who had intelligence connections. You had a meeting that I document in the book. The day after that UFO cover-up live show took place, there was a meeting in the office of the counterintelligence director at the CIA. And Ronald Pendolfi was there, who was the head of the weird desk that runs the UFO files. Kit Green, that had the files before him, was in the meeting. Hennessy, who was there, who was a head of stealth technology, all the security for stealth technology was there. And the guy who was in charge of the Roswell report for President Clinton. These people were all in the office, and they're talking about this UFO cover-up live show the night before and talking about Richard Doty. Well, how did they know Richard Doty was there? This was all CIA. That show was entirely CIA. It was run by the CIA. The Falcon, who Bill Moore said was a high-level CIA guy, Bill Moore confirmed to me, because I got the story, he was sitting in the audience. There was only a couple of people in the audience because it was a live show, and there was a studio audience. It was just a couple of people. So here you have this top-level CIA guy is watching this thing being filmed. They've got a link into the Soviet Union. They have just totally CIA, and they're releasing material that was classified and would be classified till 1995. And the CIA has a meeting the next day, and they're talking about Richard Doty and saying, oh, the guy's just he's a phony type thing. And then Kit Green says, well, he passed the lie detector test. So here you have a meeting taking place about an event the night before. And it just simply shows that it was controlled. They're having a meeting to see how it had gone, how did this thing come across, and it just sort of died away as another phony thing with bad music. And when you take a look at the thing and you go into real detail and start looking at who the producer was, who was running it, all this sort of stuff, it just comes across that it was a setup to get the material out, and because they had the bad music and they had the alien eating ice cream, strawberry ice cream, everybody just sort of threw it out, and the story got out, and the actual story died, but the material got out.
We got to go to a break in about 30 or 40 seconds. Very quickly, Annie Jacobson came out with a best-selling book a year ago about Area 51, a great book about the history of legitimate national security programs out there. But in the end, she drops a bombshell about flying saucers being built by Joseph Stalin, based on Nazi technology, flown by concentration camp survivors. It threw the whole thing into a big question mark. Well, the music is telling us we need to go to a break, but we'll pick that up on the other side and then take questions from the audience. Much more to come here with Grant Cameron on Coast to Coast AM. So, Grant, before the break, I'm asking you about Annie Jacobson's book. It's a bombshell at the end of the book. Great book about Area 51, but then she says at the end, she's got a source who says, yes, there were saucers at Area 51, but they weren't aliens. They were from the USSR, sent by Stalin, built by Nazis, and the aliens who were flying them were actually surgically altered concentration camp survivors operated on by Joseph Mengele. Pretty wild stuff. What do you make of it?
Of course, it's totally stupid. It's like the crash test dummies being dropped, you know, 5 years after Roswell explaining the bodies. It comes down to me like when you have skeptics that come on Larry King or any show, it doesn't really matter what they say. It's like just say something, put out some stupid explanation, and it's hard to fight off. Annie Jacobson was sort of like just sort of like a sitting duck. She had talked to the Roadrunners and gotten all that and did some research. But when it came to UFOs, it's what you said at the beginning of the show. This is a steep learning curve, and you've run up against it when people want to come and do an Area 51 thing, and I've run up against it when people want to do the presidential thing, and you get a phone call from some 25-year-old girl who's the chief researcher and hasn't read a UFO book, and it's like, tell them whatever you want. They're going to do it, and it's like, unless you have a background in this thing, you are easy to set up, and because it's a lot, it's a very steep learning curve, and you got a lot to learn to weed out the wheat from the chaff.
Well, we agree on that. East of the Rockies, Jeff in Cleveland. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. George, you guys are reporting, in fact, you did it tonight, on these giant triangles that are out there. And I'm wondering if Grant has ever done any investigation on them and if there's some kind of a cover-up, because it would seem to me that as big as they are and as frequent as they keep being mentioned, that network news ought to be picking up on them, and they're obviously not. And I'll take my answer up here.
I think it's a good point, and you'd think that people would see them taking off and landing in bases as big as they are. What's your take on that?
Well, I agree that probably a lot of this is American military technology, but, I mean, as with Area 51, nobody knew anything until you guys broke it. I mean, they could fly it out of there behind mountains where they're up into the, you know, high atmosphere before they ever get over populated areas, or they could be flying it from some island in the middle of the Pacific or something like that. They have unlimited amounts of money, but an interesting story is, I got involved with UFOs back in 1975, just north of the Minuteman III missile silos that were aimed at Russia. This is 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War, and I had four dramatic sightings. And one of them, we had some objects on the ground. We were flashing lights at them, and suddenly this thing appeared in the sky, came around, was a giant triangle. It sat right on top of the car. It was the most terrifying moment of my life. This happened in April of 1976 in Canada. So the triangles have been around for an awful long time, but I would agree that a lot of the stuff that's flying around now is basically American technology, which is why I really don't do sightings, because when it comes to sightings, the most you're ever going to get with sightings is an unknown. Whether it's sightings or whether it's a photograph, the best you're going to get is an unknown. And the prime example of that is the NARCAP, when they had the airplane thing with at O'Hare. They had the UFO over there. NARCAP, which is a big UFO scientific group, put together the best people in the UFO community to look at what this thing was. They put out a 152-page report, spent 9 months working on this thing, and they basically came to the conclusion, unknown. You really cannot determine anything from sightings. So I've sort of moved into the area of consciousness that I say that unless you get inside the craft or talk to the people that are flying it, we aren't going anywhere in ufology. It's game over. There's nothing more you can learn about sightings, because now it's even worse, because you can't tell whether it's high-tech American stuff, whether it's flying saucers. You can't determine anything by what's flying around in the sky. The only thing you can do is you've got to get inside the craft, or you've got to talk to the people in there, or you've got to get a legitimate government piece of hardware, document, whistleblower, the government coming out. Otherwise, sightings really don't get us anywhere.
Yeah, it's a tough nut to crack. Some friends of mine here in Las Vegas, NIDS organization doesn't exist anymore, did a study of triangles, and I think they concluded that a lot of them look like they might be ours, but some of them seem to behave in ways that suggest they belong to somebody else. I think some researchers have guessed that maybe these giant platforms are up there all the time, and they're involved in sort of sucking up information, emails, computer records, things of that sort, some part of a surveillance program. But until somebody comes forward and spills the beans, we're just not going to know. West of the Rockies, Jason in Washington. Hi, Jason.
Brent, what's the story of Colonel Weinbrenner's deathbed note? Can you tell the audience that?
It wasn't a deathbed note. We got this. I got an email from a guy in San Antonio, Texas. He was asking me for Bob Emenegger's email, so I gave him email, phone number, and he contacted Bob. And then Bob came to me and said, "Oh, this guy, his wife had been the." What do you call it? She wasn't a nurse. She was sort of an attendant at Weinbrenner's, sort of like an old folks' home where he died. And what the husband would do is the husband would Google search the various clients. And these were all like high-ranking colonels, generals at this place in San Antonio where all the high-ranking officials would get apartments, and then you go from the apartment to sort of a care place. And so he had Google searched Weinbrenner's background for his wife so that she would have something to talk to the patients about, and had discovered this story that it was on my website about Bob Emmenegger going to Weinbrenner's office during the making of this documentary. And that's when he said to Weinbrenner, he walked up to his desk and he said, "Tell me about the landing of the alien spacecraft at Holloman Air Force Base." And Weinbrenner started to draw a MiG-25 on the board and started ranting and raving about weather alterations and stuff. And Emmenegger was saying, "Well, you know, maybe he didn't hear my question. Like, well, what's going on here?" And then he hands him the book, this famous story where Weinbrenner hands him the book, J. Allen Hynek book, and opens the front cover while he's ranting about MiGs and, you know, alterations. And it has "To My Friend General Weinbrenner, J. Allen Hynek." And then Emmenegger got the idea that Weinbrenner thought the office was bugged, and he was confirming, "Yes, this is for real, but I can't talk to you about this." And anyway, so he had picked up this story. The husband had picked up this story and had told it to his wife. So his wife, wanting to talk to Weinbrenner about something, says, "Well, I understand you were involved in UFOs." And at first Weinbrenner said, "No, it was nothing. I wasn't involved," and stuff. And then he gave the wife a Star Wars passport. And this was a Star Wars passport that was being sold somewhere, and said, "Give this to your husband." And then it was at the end, when near his death, he said to the caregiver, the wife, he said, "I just wanted to let you know that we had 5 aliens in Utah." And that was all he said. He didn't say at an underground base, they were dead, they were alive. And this was a story that the husband had got from the wife, from Weinbrenner. And he was trying to get this to Bob Emmenegger. So we went down there, and we tried to interview the wife, but she was from El Salvador or something, and they had divorced since the incident, and we just couldn't understand her. I mean, she was just – I mean, I could not – I talked to her on the phone, and we just could not communicate with her. But this was basically the story that Weinbrenner had said after denying UFOs for so long, and he was head of FTD – he was the head of the foreign technology at Wright-Patterson. He was a guy that should have known about UFOs and basically told her, "We had 5 aliens in Utah."
Wow. Thanks for the call, Jason. Going to go to our wild card line, Dawson in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Dawson.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I just want to throw this out there about possibly when MJ-12 went rogue and quit reporting to the president. Because, you know, we hear about him during Truman. And possibly an Eisenhower, some of the same people would have carried over in that administration. And then about the time that we lost JFK, you know, Truman didn't know about the atomic bomb until they made him president. They had kept that from him. And I'm really wondering if maybe Kennedy had kept it from LBJ. And about the time that we lose Kennedy, maybe the guys that would have been the current MJ-12 people during that administration, maybe they just decided at that time they wanted to quit reporting to the president and take it underground and keep it to themselves. Because we hear the Nixon story with Jackie Gleason, but really after LBJ, it seems like it just drops off the map for presidents talking about it.
Good point, Dawson. You're talking to the right guy. I don't think anybody has done more work on which presidents know about UFOs than Grant. What do you think, Grant?
I've gone back and forth. I can tell both sides of the story. I can tell you, give you a lecture that says the president doesn't know. I can give you a lecture that says the president does know. I tend to think the president does know, and that this is plausible deniability, that constitutionally he has to know. If your president is not running the country, if there is a rogue group of people running the country, you guys are in a lot of trouble down there. And one example I can give you is Obama goes last year to Roswell. Before the election, Roswell is always like New Mexico is a swing state, and he makes this famous statement where when you go to Roswell, you got to make a UFO joke. So yeah. His UFO joke that opened his speech was, the question that's asked to me most by 9 and 10-year-old children, boys, is, what really happened at Roswell? What is the truth? And Obama says, I tell these little boys, if I told you the truth, I'd have to kill you. And then, of course, the crowd laughs, and this is his joke, and there's a pause in the speech, and then Obama says, "We'll keep our secrets on Roswell." And so that indicated to me that here's a Democrat, left-wing Democrat. It's always been rumored that the Republicans know, because they're more pro-military, that guys like Carter, Clinton, Obama, these people would be out of the loop. I still think that he has to know that he's in charge of all the intelligence, and that a lot of this stuff, that there's a secret government behind the government and all this sort of stuff, is just something to divert attention away from the president. There's so much money. There's so much technology. If they're flying stuff at Area 51, Clinton sent guys to Area 51. He even talks about it in a speech in 2005 in Hong Kong. He's asked by the guy who's running this thing for this big investment company. He says, because I'm running this thing, I can ask you this question. And he says to Clinton, he says, what about do the presidents pass secrets from one president to another? For example, where's Jimmy Hoffa's body buried, or what really happened at Roswell? And Clinton starts talking about Roswell, that he asked for the records. And he basically says, you know, that I'm probably not the first president they kept in the dark, or that bureaucrats have tried to wait out. But still, he sent someone to, he said that everybody in his administration believed that Roswell wasn't real, but that Area 51, he didn't mention the base, but he said a base in Nevada, that there was an alien there and a spacecraft underground, and I sent someone there. So Clinton was very interested, and I think a guy like that is going to get the answer in terms of the basis, the basic parts of it, maybe not the details, but he has to have oversight. I can't see how it would work, all the amount of research going on, say at Area 51 and advanced technology, he has to know. And let me give you one last example and go next call, is that if you go to the presidential libraries, you will find nothing on UFOs, but you will also find absolutely not a single file on remote viewing. And I talked to Hal Puthoff, and Hal assured me they were briefed. And Jimmy Carter, in his diary, actually talks about being briefed on remote viewing. And he said it was one of the most fascinating things he'd seen in his president. It was unexplainable. If you go to the day when he said he was briefed, you will not find it in the presidential record. So because there is no records, does not mean the president is briefed. There's nothing on remote viewing. There's nothing on UFOs. I think the president has to know constitutionally. He has to be in charge of the whole operation, because all the intelligence people report to him, all the military report to him, the executive branch, or the government itself, he's the chief executive officer. It doesn't matter where the people who are controlling it are, they still report to him. And people are very patriotic in the United States. There would be defections. If this thing was being run out of it, you would have people in the government defect. And I think they're following the rules because there's no defections. And because Dr. Eric Walker, one of the things he told us is he got very angry at one point in one of the interviews. He said, listen, why should we change the rules just to satisfy your curiosity? And he said this out of the blue, which gave me the indication. He said, why should we change the rules? There are rules that people are following. And when Bill Moore tried to help me, he sent Kit Green, who was a guy who Bill Moore said was the guy who would brief the president, that would answer questions on UFOs for the president. He went in to see Walker. Walker basically threw this guy out of the office, and Walker said, the president didn't say I have to talk to you, I'm not talking about this, and basically threw Kit Green out of the room. So, again, there you have an indication that the president is in charge, and there are rules, and that people inside the government are basically following the rules. Anybody who works for government, I work for government, I know that there is, like, paperwork and rules galore, that it's very rare to have something off the record.
Try to get one more quick call in. Danny in Kentucky, and our first-time caller, you got to make the question quick, and the answer's got to be quick, too. We've got about a minute.
There you go. I appreciate you taking my call. I know kind of what Grant's going through. I had a ship that landed on my farm, and I went to it, and there were aliens inside. But I got a lot to talk about. You got my phone number there on your caller ID. Have Grant call me back. I got a lot of information where I examined the ship. I know all about the people. They can't speak a word. There's a lot that I know that nobody else does know.
Well, okay, I got the perfect person to follow up. If you get the number, we'll follow up on it.
I'll ask Gina to get that number for us. Danny, thanks for calling us. Grant, so the book comes out tomorrow.
Yep.
And people can get it how?
There'll be a link on my site, which is presidentialufo.com. There'll be a link on Richard Dolan's site, and they can get it through Amazon.com. And they can also, I think it's available also in Europe and Great Britain, and basically through Amazon or through our website. So there'll be links all over the place.
Well, I congratulate you. It's a tremendous piece of work, and I think, you know, I think knowing you a little bit, it's not done. It's never going to be finished because there's always going to be other leads to follow. In fact, I've got a couple for you, in particular about Robert Sarbacher, some personal information that I'll share with you that gives you, I think, shares some new light, but we'll do that off the air. And I really appreciate you being here.
Beautiful, and I appreciate your taking the time and lending your credibility to our book.
Well, it's, you know, it's a convoluted story, and I think it's made convoluted on purpose, as you point out in the book. So it's hard for people to follow it. So you got to be dedicated to, you know, a reader out there or a listener to this program has to be dedicated to follow up on it. And I hope people will check out your book.
Beautiful. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Grant Cameron is the co-author of UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, along with Scott Crane. Check out that book. Want to say thanks also to Dr. Artie Clark, to Richard Dolan and John Lear, and to David, Gina, Tim Banal, Lex, and Dan, all my colleagues there at Premier. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next month. Good night, everyone.